All right. Hang on 1 second, people. Here we go.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Since ancient times, Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. The solar wind is a mild 608.9 kilometers per second. However, this wind has resulted in a geomagnetic storm that generated an aurora borealis as far south as Alaska. Sunspots 969 and 970 pose no threat for solar flares, so all is quiet, although people on the West Coast are experiencing very warm temperatures right now. Armadillo Aerospace Corporation founder John Carmack is confident he can beat out eight other competitors in the Lunar Lander contest. He just missed the Northrop Grumman Lunar Lander Challenge at the 2006 Wirefly X Prize Cup. And that year, it is good to see that NASA is encouraging the best to come out through an open competition. If you think you know the best way to drive around the moon, get your prototype to the folks down at Wirefly. And congratulations to Peter Janeskins of the SETI Institute and colleagues who predicted the Saturday morning Oregon meteor shower. It arrived right on time, even though Earth has not seen debris from this comet since 4 AD. Its gorgeous blue-green fireballs were seen even in a bright moon sky between 3:30 and 4:30 a.m. Pacific time. Also in the news, Hurricane Felix is now a Category 4 and growing, so get your surfboards out. This one's going to be a doozy. And lastly, good news and bad news in the nuclear armament race. North Korea announced that they are dismantling their nuke program, while Tehran announced they have just completed their 3,000th centrifuge for enriching uranium into weapons-grade plutonium. Global diplomacy fun ahead for all this fall. Last week, I was at the Bay Area UFO Conference. What a great event that was. George Noory and I met for the first time after nearly 3 years of talking on the radio together. The people were great, and the success of our ventures continue to grow. And last week, I just want to thank everybody for their help as we ran an archive last week, and also for your great support and appearance at the San Francisco Bay Area UFO Expo. Victoria Jack, who was the organizer of the event, reported a record year. Almost 1,200 people showed up for that, and every workshop was well attended. Lots of people on the floor and just excellent guests. Everybody was great. This week, we have a special guest on our program. He is the foremost Egyptian mythologist, in my opinion, in the world. He has more books and lectures out there on DVD and in print than anyone else on this subject of Egypt and the meaning behind the artifacts found there. He's a great lecturer, and I highly recommend him for an appearance in your town. Please welcome with me William Henry. How are you, William?
Wonderful, Brooks. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Is it hot out there in Nashville here, as it is here?
Yeah, it was pretty warm today, actually. Some low 90s, something like that, which is considerably cooler than it was a couple of weeks ago when we had triple digits for several weeks in a row.
Oh, my gosh. And about 200% humidity to go along with it, right?
Right.
I know you've been busy lately. You just got back from Arizona, didn't you?
I was in Phoenix and Sedona. Yeah, Dr. Zahi Hawass came into Sedona to put a presentation on, and so I went out there to attend that and just kind of rub elbows with him a little bit and just kind of see what I could see and hear what I could hear.
Wow. Well, that's going to be synergistic with things coming up we'll talk about in our third hour. I used to live in Tennessee. I lived there for about 16 years. And realizing that it is one of the original 13 colonies, it also has amazing alignments with Egypt. So let's talk about the cities and the synchronicity of Tennessee with Egypt.
Yeah, it's very, very intriguing how, especially here in Tennessee, there's an effort to sort of recreate the ancient world. We have, of course, Memphis, Tennessee, which sits there on the Mississippi, which is referred to as the American Nile. And as you come up the Mississippi from Memphis, you find yourself in Cairo, Illinois, and you find yourself right near Cahokia, Illinois, next to St. Louis, where there's this massive pyramidal structure. And then when you come over here to Nashville, now you've got the sort of the descendants of the Egyptians, the Greeks coming in and influencing things. Of course, the Greeks derived much of their knowledge from ancient Egypt, and what they were able to distill from that ancient civilization, they built into their main town, which was known as Athens, a center of learning. And Nashville is actually called the Athens of the South, and there's this just very strange centuries-old effort that's been going on to recreate ancient Athens in modern Nashville.
Well, that seems, very remarkable. I mean, we go to Washington, D.C., and the alignment with ancient civilizations is obvious there, and probably for obvious reasons, because being a very young nation, rebel colonies breaking away from Mother England, we kind of wanted to establish our own antiquity, our own wisdom, without having any real age on our nation, and so we build our buildings to sort of replicate antiquity, and we arrange them in power ratios that go all the way back to Freemason fame. But why Tennessee?
Well, the best answer that I can give for that, Brooks, is comes from actually from Dr. J.J. Hertog. He had channeled a book in the 1970s called The Keys of Enoch. And it purports to be a book of knowledge for the end times, and a time when presumably Enoch would return, and you would also have a messianic age then, and that's the term I use, not Dr. Hertog. So in this book, which contains some very highly reliable information, many people believe, by the way, he has this extraordinary map. He shows 12 cities that ring the planet, almost like what I call a pearl necklace of sacred sites. The centerpiece on this map is the Great Pyramid, of course, Cairo. He also shows the region in the center of the Atlantic where many propose Atlantis was located. I'm paraphrasing the map, just kind of going around it, and by my memory here, he shows a region in southwestern France near Lourdes, France, which is very close to Rennes-le-Château, ground zero for the Gnostic Christian mysteries. He shows a region in Mongolia. He shows another region in China. Another spot is in the Philippines. He wraps around. He comes into Hawaii. He shows Vancouver, British Columbia on the west coast of North America. He shows Oak Island, Nova Scotia, a Knights Templar Mystery Center on the east coast. And in the mainland of America, he shows two sites. One is in the Four Corners area in the southwest, where Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah all come together. And then he shows a second site and claims that this second site will be, along with the Hopi region, a city of light, a place where enlightened knowledge will manifest. And in the book, he identifies this place as running on a corridor from Lexington, Kentucky to Nashville, Tennessee. But then Dr.
Right.
Hertog came to Nashville in 1999 for one of his famous Easter programs and proclaimed to the audience there that he thought that this site was actually Nashville, Tennessee. So to answer your question, it appears that Nashville could be on a rotating circle or ring of sacred sites where throughout time knowledge has been secreted away, and these places from time to time become activated as centers of awakening.
Well, you think back to the time of the founding of Tennessee, and I'm going back and thinking of times like Daniel Boone and Samuel Clemens, and the more sort of country version of Tennessee, and yet here in the founding of the capital city and extremely expensive real estate situated between Vanderbilt and the Capitol building is this incredible engineering feat, and it's not just a mere replica. The proportions, the layout of this area they call the Mall is just stunning. And I gotta ask, who is it that designed this? I mean, when you're coming into the forests and rivers and kind of swampy areas of Middle Tennessee, how did they decide this is the place on the earth where we're going to do this, and we're going to use a sizable amount of our state product to build this? Whose idea was it?
Well, actually, what we're talking about here is a site that sits at the base of our state capitol that features a 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that has each of the seven chakras or energy centers of the human body perfectly marked with appropriate symbolism. This site was designed by a local architect who's involved in a lot of civic projects. His name is Kim Hinton. and he designed this as a project to commemorate Tennessee's bicentennial, which was in 1996. And as you mentioned, the state of Tennessee spent $55 million to build this, what ended up being a temple complex that is officially identified as the sister complex to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and its official title is the Bicentennial Capitol Mall. And here we have to be clear that we're not talking about a shopping mall. Like the mall in D.C., we're talking about a Pall Mall, a walkway, an open space, a garden where people congregate that has a specific purpose, and that is to commemorate, in this case, Tennessee's bicentennial. What the architect didn't realize until I was fortunate enough to point it out for him was that his design for this 2,200-foot-long magician's rod is a virtual dead ringer for a diagram of what is known as Mystic Mount Meru, a place that is referred to as the cosmic axis, the ladder or stairway to heaven, which is thought to have existed at one time in a place called Shambhala, the realm of the immortals, the realm of the gods. And it just becomes really curious as to how this synchronicity occurred. When I sent the diagram over to the architect, Kim Hinton, he said he could see why, to the untrained eye, I might see a similarity in the diagrams. And by the way, there's an article on my website, williamhenry.net, that features these diagrams side by side, and an article called City of Secrets, which is about Nashville and its temple complexes. So this architect is saying, hey, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. There's no similarity here. And when plainly to even the untrained eye, there is a similarity, and even to trained eyes. I've walked this place with thousands of people since 1999 when I first apprehended this connection. I've been there with artists, musicians, writers, painters, architects, engineers, physicists, you name it, and they all can see the similarity between the two diagrams. Everybody sees it except the architect himself. And so people say, well, he must be covering up something, or he's working for somebody, or, you know, his ego won't enable him to see it. Whatever it is, it's there. And the bottom line is, when I've walked the place, even with other contractors that were involved, and they're kind of angry about what I say about it, because they treat it as their own property, as their own private property. They built it. It's theirs. You know, people like me can just stay away. And what I'm saying to them is that likely you did not set out to duplicate an ancient temple complex that is, in fact, the basis for myths such as the Tower of Babel, myths such as the ladder or stairway to heaven. Even the story Jack and the Beanstalk can be referred back to this story, this ancient story of Meru, the ladder to heaven. So I'm saying you guys didn't set out to do that, but look at the result. That's all I'm saying. And if it looks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, you guys may have laid a duck right here in downtown Nashville.
Well, I mean, did Kim think that he was designing this out of whole cloth? I mean, did he have some templates that he went by, or did he just
Well, you know, and that's what's interesting, Brooks, because after several attempts to get a copy of the diagram from me were futile, I just simply, out of my own ego or whatever, said, I don't feel like having anything to do with this guy. I mean, he basically said, I'm full of crap, you know, so why would I want to suddenly start supplying him with my research? So after several of these attempts on his behalf to contact me, including three phone calls and a letter, he finally shows up uninvited on one of my tours. And so I just kind of pulled back and told my gang that I was with, the group I was with, said, hey, you know, here's the main man. He's the guy that designed this place. And, you know, talk with him about it. And at that moment, you would expect him to say, well, now listen, kids, if you're going to design a 2,200-foot-long mall, architectural design principles, gardening principles dictate that it can only look a certain way. And you're going to divide it into seven sections. This is just the way we've done it for thousands of years. He didn't say anything like that, nothing like that. Instead, the first thing out of his mouth was, now there's nothing weird going on down here. And my response to him was, what are you talking about weird? We're just out here taking a walk in a park. And he starts then to tell us that everything we see is purely decorative and serves no purpose whatsoever except to commemorate Tennessee's bicentennial and to provide an unobstructed view of the state capitol. And the funny thing about that, Brooks, is that as he's saying that, I'm standing on the middle of this iron rod that is drilled directly into the center of what they call the Court of Three Stars, this enormous Stonehenge-looking like temple that caps this long magician's rod. And as you stand on this iron rod, they have built a very strange acoustical effect into the design so that when you stand on that rod and make a sound out loud, you hear your voice as if it's amplified or reverberating in your head, yet a person standing just 2 feet beside you hears your voice as normal.
Wow.
And so I'm thinking, okay, sir, so you designed this place to provide an unobstructed view of the state capitol. Why, then, did you go to all this incredible expense to create this amazing acoustical effect?
And what did he say about the acoustical effect?
Well, he said they did it just because they could.
Hey, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this? Yeah, I could see that. Well, now, Nashville is your home. Did you choose to live in Nashville because of its Egyptian alignments, or did the existence of the constructions cause you to take up mythology as a specialty, or all?
No, I mean, actually what happened, Brooks, I grew up in near Detroit, Michigan. My father was a tax attorney who specialized in the music business. And in 1981, it was pretty much lights out in Detroit. It was just the beginning of the Reagan administration and the end of 22% interest rates and all that stuff that was sinking Detroit. My father actually was a huge Johnny Cash fan and came home one day and announced that he had bought a home in between Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison and loaded up the kids and like the Beverly Hillbillies in reverse. We moved from Motown to Music City, USA. And so began kind of the adventure, and I went to school here at a local college called Belmont College that offered an entertainment music business program. I was going to be an entertainment lawyer, go work for Pamela Anderson or something,
Yeah.
And the thing about this college was that it was a Baptist college, and in order to get a degree from this school, you had to take religion classes. You had to take Bible study classes.
Right.
And I knew about as much about the Bible as I do about how to fly a space shuttle. And so started getting into this class, and this was actually 1982, the fall of 1982. And there was a brand new book on the bestseller list called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And this was the book that ultimately 15 years later, 20 years later, fell into the hands of Dan Brown and caused him to write the Da Vinci Code. And when I read that book in 1982, I just fell in love with this notion and the research presented that there's this whole parallel mystery tradition that's been covered up for centuries, and it's esoterically based. And something in that just rang true with me, and actually it sort of rang a bell in me. It's like, oh, this sounds really, really familiar to me. And so that's what started my whole research quest.
Wow. So, and the research didn't stop. I mean, your library grew, and then when this, I don't know what they had to raise to make room for this mall in Nashville, but it just sort of all falls together for William Henry, and you've made, a sizable career out of showing people the synchronicities of this mall in Tennessee.
Yeah, I mean, actually what happened, I was writing it was actually my second book, which was called The Atomic Christ, about FDR's search for the Holy Grail. I had been just riveted by this story, what I now realize are considered to be the single most unreported story of the 21st century, when FDR sent a mystic guru named Nicholas Roeg to Mongolia in search of the reincarnated Jesus and the secrets of the Holy Grail. Well, there was a third person involved. His name was Henry A. Wallace, who was FDR's two-term Secretary of Agriculture and third-term VP. And it turns out that there was a whole cache of letters that were written by Henry Wallace to Nicholas Roeg during the course of this expedition. And I got a hold of these letters from the Roosevelt Library, the FDR Library in Hyde Park, New York, and started looking at them and recognized right away why most of the historians that had looked at these letters just got glassy-eyed looking at them, because they were all written in code. But the code that they were written in was all Holy Grail code. They were searching for the Grail, and he made constant esoteric references to the Grail. And one of those letters led me to the idea, this is in 1999, one of those letters led me to the idea that FDR and Henry Wallace and Nicholas Roerich planned to return the results of their search in Mongolia to Nashville.
How in the world did you find that out?
Well, do we have just about 5 minutes here? I'll tell you.
Well, sure.
Okay. In one of the letters, which was dated March of 1933, Wallace writes to Roerich, who he refers to as his guru, and he tells them that they're awaiting the stone, which is the term that they use for the Holy Grail. It's the stone of destiny, the stone of light, all those terms applied to the Holy Grail. And he says in this letter specifically that they await the stone in the new country, which is America.
Right.
And then he gives this sort of this cryptic piece of clue as to where they're going to return these secrets. And he says specifically that they're going to return them to the new country where the seven stars are found under the sign of the three stars.
Well, so, that sounds pretty clear. To someone who lives in Tennessee, it's perfect.
Well, right. So what he's saying, where the seven stars are under the three stars. So I'm thinking, okay, he's talking about America. You go to your almanac of state flags and you find that there's only one state flag in the Union that has only three stars. In fact, most state flags don't have stars. They have animals or other symbols. The only flag with only three stars is the flag of the state of Tennessee.
Right, and I think Texas has one star.
It has one star, right. So I'm thinking, okay, what if he's talking about Tennessee? Where in Tennessee, the sign of the three stars, do we find the sign of the seven stars? Well, when you go to your almanac of star legends and star lore, you find that there's two groups of seven stars that appear over and over again in myth and scripture, and both of them have significant Tennessee connections. The first group of seven stars is the Pleiades, which are called the seven doves, the seven sisters. There's lots of names for them, because you know these constellations and the stars, they change names throughout the eons, right?
Right.
And so I'm thinking, okay, what is the Pleiadian connection to East Tennessee? Well, it's significant, first, that after General Leslie Groves finished building the Pentagon, the world's largest building for FDR, he was sent to East Tennessee, to Oak Ridge, Tennessee specifically, to build a mysterious city that would build materials for the Manhattan Project. And Groves said that he selected East Tennessee because of something about the geology of the area. Like what? Okay?
Well, I can't think of any special geology in Oak Ridge.
Yeah, I know. But what is special about that area is that you're in Cherokee Indian Territory.
Right.
And at that time I was reading a book called Voices of Our Ancestors by Diani Wehu. She's a 27th generation Cherokee Indian storyteller who was given permission to write Cherokee Indian creation mythology after we landed on a man on the moon in July 1969. And this is, I'm paraphrasing, the creation tale that she tells in the first chapter of her book, Voices of Our Ancestors. She says that the Cherokee were created by beams of light from the Pleiades, who rode a sound wave through a hole in space over East Tennessee and created the Cherokee as guardians of one of 12 such portals that ring the planet.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I'm thinking, wow, okay, there's a Pleiadian connection for you. That's Cherokee creation mythology. Maybe that explains something about why Groves was there. I don't know. The second group of seven stars that turns up in myth and scripture is the Big Dipper, which is also called Ursa Major. It's also called Arthur's chariot. It's called in ancient Egypt the Casket of Osiris. One of its most ancient names is Meru. Okay?
As in N-E-R-U.
M-E-R-U. M is in
Meru.
Meru. Right. But its oldest name, when you dig down to the very bedrock of star legend and star lore, you find that the oldest name in Arabia for Ursa Major is Nash. And what Nash means is the great casket, the sacred casket. Well, Brooks, Nashville, Tennessee is known to be built on an ancient Indian burial ground where vast numbers of bodies had been interred by the ancients who lived here. And so with that, I'm thinking, wait a minute, is Wallace talking about Nashville, Tennessee, is the, where the seven stars meet the sign of the three stars? And so I start driving around, looking around, just kind of saying, show me anything that relates to the Holy Grail. And I'm driving down Jefferson Street in downtown Nashville, and I drive by this giant 20-foot-tall red granite monolith with this pattern etched into it, laser etched into it, a pillar pattern, a what looks like a magician's rod or wand that's topped by three stars. And I look at that and I say, wait a minute, I've seen that before. And I go home and I get out my book on sacred mountains of Asia and I pull out the drawing of Mount Meru from a 2nd century Chinese manuscript and I lay the two diagrams side by side and there's a near perfect match.
Oh my gosh. Now who laser etched the red granite monolith?
That I don't know. You're like Jim Mars, you know. When he came up here, he took a walk of the place with me. He looked at everything. I want to know who built that. Who financed that? What are the names of the people? Because I want to track back their bloodlines and their connections. And I'm like, I don't know, Jim. I'm just, I don't have that level of detail on it, exactly who manufactured it or who is responsible for it. But overall responsibility of it, of the project, did go to Kem Hinton. And in fact, he wrote a book called A Long Path about the development of the mall, and all it does is play right into my story. It's incredible.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have Jim on the program in October, so I'm definitely going to make a note to bring that up. What did you feel when you were at the mall with William Henry? Well, tell me about the temples that are in the Tennessee. I mean, are they similar to the temples that are in Egypt?
Well, no, they're derivatives because remember Nashville is a recreation of ancient Athens, and the Athenian temples are basically derivatives of the Egyptian temples. And so, for example, we have here a scale replica of the Parthenon from ancient Athens, which was Athena's temple of holy wisdom. And this is a really, really wild place. It's they went to extraordinary lengths. They did 8-10 years worth of research in Athens in order to not just build a scale replica, but an exact replica as possible of Athena's Parthenon, complete with the tallest indoor statue in the Western world, a 42-foot-tall statue of Pallas Athena that's completely covered in gold. It's magnificent.
Wow.
And this was actually, the Parthenon was originally built in Nashville in 1897 to commemorate Tennessee's centennial. They had a huge World's Fair here like they did in Chicago and to celebrate the Columbian Exposition, like the Paris World's Fair when they built the Eiffel Tower. So at that time, these cities around the world were building these incredible structures in hopes of attracting people to these cities so that then they would stay and do business in the place. And so that's how the Parthenon came to Nashville. But it's got just a really, really wild vibe about it. I mean, people actually do think of it as a working temple. People go there to worship Athena. Officially, they call it a museum. It's a civic facility purely, but it's incredible that here in the buckle of the Bible Belt, we have this incredible monument to the ultimate pagan goddess.
Well, it seems strange that a state would spend its marketing dollars on Elvis to get us to come to Memphis and Johnny Cash to get us to come to Nashville when it's really the alignment, the incredible architectural and engineering and spiritual alignment of Tennessee with Egypt that should be the main draw. It's what the original architects had in mind when they laid out this ancient plan to make Tennessee show up on the map. It just wasn't something that was 1,200 miles from the coast, something that most Europeans might not make the trip for. But if they built these antiquities with enough detail and used enough symbolism behind them, maybe they could get European explorers to come inland to Tennessee. And little did they know how they were playing into the future and maybe laying the groundwork for events prior to the end of the age in 2012. We'll cover that in a little more detail in the next hour. My question is, are the temples in Tennessee functional? I mean, are there ceremonies there similar to the ceremonies they have in Egypt from time to time?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't personally participated in ceremonies. Well, I take that back. Let me just first mention one other thing, if I may,
yeah.
Brooks, on your point there. This is, you know, you always have, when you're doing this kind of research, you have what the archaeologists say, then you have what the local lore says about a place. And here in Nashville, the local lore says that the vast numbers of bodies that are interred in the sacred coffin that is Nashville, meaning the place was an ancient necropolis, an ancient city of the dead, some of the people that are there are the mysterious Mandan Indians. And local lore says that it was actually the Mandans who were responsible for the construction of the Royal Pyramid that sat by the river here in Nashville, which was at the location of the Bicentennial Mall where the sacred graveyard is, the sacred burial ground. The Mandans are white-skinned, white-haired, blue-eyed Indians who are usually associated with North and South Dakota, but also were here in Tennessee. And as I was learning about the Mandans of North America and the mysteries that are associated with them, including the fact that Thomas Jefferson was very interested in the Mandans, just as he was in his Celtic Druid ancestry, and sent Dunbar and Clark into this area looking for the mounds of the stone grave race, the Mandans and the mound builders, wanting to know where they were and what was in them. What we find about these Mandans, or at least what I found was so interesting, is that there's another group of individuals who refer to themselves as the Mandans. And these were the followers of John the Baptist, who went to Iraq. And what is so interesting about this, I'm thinking, wow, so linguistically, Mandan and Mandan, the names of these two groups, is identical. I wonder if there's a connection between the two. Could they possibly be the same people?
And what did you find?
Pardon me?
And what did you find?
Well, I found a really incredible book by a scholar by the name of Graham Kersley, who had written a book on Mayan Genesis and on the Asian creation myths and migrations of people from the Old World to the New World, and principally suggesting that the Hindus came to South America and were also great influencers of the Maya and other Central American civilizations.
And what time was that the Hindus came there?
Oh, off the top of my head, I'm thinking he's saying at least 1,000 years ago. I could look it up.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know in Bolivia, the Fuente Bull is an artifact that was found in Bolivia. It dates about that time,
mm-hmm.
Right about the time of Christ,
mm.
That shows Sumerian writing. And I know that the Sumerians did not visit Bolivia, so I'm kind of wondering if there was a common route, or was there some kind of world traveler that went around teaching people advanced languages?
Right, right. Well, the point that I was making here is that Graham Kersley, in his book, and this is a scholar, is saying that the Mandans of North America and the Mandans of Iraq are the same.
Wow.
I mean, what that opens up is the possibility that the followers of John the Baptist were here in Nashville which they put the conservative date on the timing of these graves, they put it at around 400 A.D. So we're in the ballpark anyway, time-wise, and it suggests to me this possibility that, yeah, maybe they did have awareness long ago that Nashville was one of these power centers. And where would they have gotten that knowledge? I mean, Hertog got it from Enoch, but certainly Enoch, the Enoch that Hertog refers to, was one of the principal influencers of the Essenes.
Well, of course. And, you know, Enoch vacated the planet along with his entire city of followers before the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And left records. And I know the Book of Enoch was translated into Slavonic in the early 18th century, and there was certainly no copy here in the U.S. until probably the early 20th century. But it was kind of thrown out by canon as a myth, as a bunch of fables. But
right.
Here we see again powerful synchronicities. Now, you mentioned the architect and the fact that he may not have known, you know, what he was doing or what he was designing, but I've had a few dealings with architects, and usually, in fact, most of the times, they're not the ones writing the check. They're the ones commissioned to come up with the design.
Right.
But have you ever followed the money to see who it was that actually paid the architect to design things the way they
right.
were?
Right. Well, the one name that is a very powerful name here in Tennessee is the name Ingram. And in fact, down at the Bicentennial Mall, they do reference Martha Ingram specifically as one who really spearheaded the project. And the history of the project, they tell us that it was in disarray until Martha Ingram came in and put private cash into the project and really got it done.
And this is Ingram of Ingram Book Company, the
Ingram
largest book distributor
Ingram
in the
Industries.
World?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Wow. So a very well-read woman.
Likely, and then she plunked down, I don't know, $150 million, a little bit more, to build a European-class orchestra hall here in Nashville that was to be for her boyfriend, Kenneth Schermerhorn, who was one time a conductor of the Nashville Symphony. He's since deceased, but she was responsible for that, and it's just extraordinary opera hall here in Nashville, symphony hall rather.
Mm. So it's possible that maybe not the founders of Nashville, but certainly the big money that came here to Nashville later in its early development had in mind something grand, something of higher meaning.
I don't have direct evidence of that, but I do find it interesting that Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall, who are a couple of Egypt researchers, Arctic Covenant researchers, got together and they collaborated on a book called Talisman. And they laid out this incredible line of research saying that there are secret societies that use the architecture of certain cities around the planet, notably Paris, London, Washington, D.C., to transmit sacred knowledge and the architecture of these cities. And they said that the easy way to tell that you're dealing with one of these talismanic cities is look for Hermes prominently placed in the city.
Really?
Well, flying high above Nashville's Union Station Hotel, one of the oldest buildings in Nashville, is Hermes.
Wow.
And so it's like, okay, so this is definitely one of these hermetic towns. Hermes was known as the Greek version of the Egyptian god of divine magic and alchemy, Thoth, who was principally identified because he's always got his magic wand in his hand that he's using to raise Osiris from the dead and transmit the key of life through this. Well, you know, it makes perfect sense why now we have this 2,200-foot rod laid out here in Nashville, Tennessee, because it is a hermetic town. It is a city where this wisdom is alive, even in the music, the key of life that comes out of Nashville.
Well, all of this is well documented, and you know, I am a kind of a scholar, and I haven't been through your tour there in Nashville, but I certainly intend to do that before the end of the year, because in January, you and I in a small group are headed for Egypt.
Yes.
for a couple of weeks. And we'll talk a little bit about that the last 10 minutes here of this hour. I did want to let people know that we're going to open the phone lines in the next 2 hours. So if you are out there listening and don't have a computer handy, the toll-free number in the U.S. is 877-876-5227. In Canada, you can also call toll-free 888-810-8322. That's 888-810-8322. And really, anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-876-3222. And that goes for Europe and New Zealand and all the other listeners that are listening live at this time. So make sure to get your phone calls stacked up for 6:30 p.m. Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern, and we'll take your phone calls. We have now 4 phone lines, so we can keep you going all night. So let's talk a little bit about that subject. Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming trip in January for this small group, and we're only talking like 20 people, right? We've got it about half filled now, don't we?
Yeah.
This is going to be no ordinary trip to Egypt. It kind of came up over breakfast in Mount Shasta. I don't know if we wrestled you to the ground and talked you into it. You said, gee, I'm thinking about going to Egypt in January. We went, yeah, okay, we're there. And now we've got half the team together, so tell us a little bit about this excursion.
Well, I just have got the bug really bad to get back there to Egypt, especially to Abydos, which is one of my favorite places to visit in Egypt, probably like the power spot on the planet. It's the temple built by Seti around the time of Moses that's built beside what is thought to be an Atlantean temple, the what is called the Osirion. And I'm so just excited about what's happening now in Egypt in terms of stuff's just kind of coming out of the ground. And so when you go with a group of like-minded people, anything's possible. I mean, anything goes right now in Egypt.
Well, you know, it's so strange. It's not just, you know, the two books that I co-authored with E.J. Clark, but The tour this year, going around the country talking about the upcoming Inner Earth Expedition and the Physics of the Soul workshop that I've been doing, it seems as though there's this, I don't know, almost like a worldwide awakening. People are just coming out of the woodwork. They're coming out of apartment buildings and libraries and schools everywhere, and they're going, hey, we really have a feeling something is about to happen, something great, and it ties, and the reason we're talking about this with William Henry in this program, because it ties ancient peoples together, and really the vast majority of their gross national products, and pulling symbolism together and establishing it, not just for their own posterity, but for eternity, so that we, in the last days, would see what they did and what they meant and what they discovered. They're not around to tell us exactly what was going on, but they left such incredible legacies for us to study and learn by. And frankly, it is overwhelmingly inspirational. And scholars like William Henry have brought it to life for us. And I, for one, want to commend you for that. And I'm really looking forward to this trip in January.
I wish it was tomorrow, Brooks. I am just so excited to get back over there and just experience everything, the smells, the tastes, the sights. It's just so incredible. And I just know, once again, that we're all on such a verge here of putting so many pieces together. And Egypt, I think, is still the place that holds the vast secrets that we all are seeking here about the ancient world, and also keys or clues to our future. And that's why it's important for us who feel a connection to Egypt to go there and to bring it back here.
Yeah, and I know one of our affiliates, Maureen St. Germain, she's got a trip coming up in October, and that's centered around the Flower of Life meditation, which is also very, very ancient. The Flower of Life actually originates in that area. But I meant to ask you, In your opinion, do you think the Egyptians were actually responsible for building the majority of the artifacts there, or do you think they were built before the Egyptians got there?
Are you trying to get me in trouble, Brooke?
No, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I know.
I have a terrible reputation in Egypt. You know, ever since National Geographic went there with me the last time I went and followed me around for 5 days for a show called Atlantis in Egypt. Atlantis, Is It Real? And what I was saying is, well, you know, this basic story of Atlantis, of a civilization that reached a high level of advancement that was in telepathic communication with this god in the center of the galaxy, or maybe even the center of the universe, that was a civilization founded by light beings that was destroyed by a cataclysm, but there were relics that were preserved before this cataclysm, and these advanced beings came and helped humankind reclaim these relics and rebuild civilization. That story is precisely told on the walls of the Temple of Edfu, the Temple of Horus at Edfu.
Yeah.
Now, this temple is built after Plato's story, but the thing about it is that it has so many other corroborating details that are not in Plato's story. And since we're told that Plato got his story from Egypt, I wondered, is it possible that this story that I just told of this advanced civilization created by light beings that were in contact with their main god in the center of the galaxy, is it possible that while this story was printed on these temple walls around 300 B.C. or so, is it possible that that story is actually far older than the time that it was printed? Well, National Geographic got a hold of that, and essentially what they deduced from it is that I'm saying that it wasn't the Egyptians who built the pyramids and some of these other temples, that it was actually the Atlanteans. And they went and got their Egyptian researchers, their official Egyptian archaeologists, who just flat said, that's racist.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're certainly not advocating anything like that here.
No, I know. And I just, when I saw that, I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. But that's basically their position, that if you say that the Egyptians didn't build this stuff, you're a bigot. Because you're saying is the Egyptians couldn't have.
Here's the thing about it. People don't build temples with blank walls and then put current events on the wall. What they do is they put things of antiquity, of great importance, that they want to preserve for coming generations who might have forgotten roots or might have forgotten history. You spend a lot of time carving out rock, stacking it in a certain way, going through all the engineering, and who knows how much blood, sweat, and tears it takes to build something like that. And then you don't carve, you know, the current events on it. You carve something that means a lot to you, some kind of monument that you want to put up. So it makes perfect sense that this story probably existed for perhaps a millennia before that building was built and those things were etched in stone.
Right. And so what does National Geographic do? They say, well, you know, William Henry's got his dates off because Plato's story was already written down when this temple was built. And it's like, okay, I see where you guys are going with this. You know, they have... I've pitched my own TV shows to New York types that produce shows for a lot of your History Channel, your Discovery, your National Geographic, blah, blah, blah. And they have... What this guy finally told me is that, you know, you're wanting to come in here and you're wanting to talk about Atlantis and that the Atlanteans built the pyramids. He said, these stations, they won't go for that because they have a franchise to protect. They're making huge dollars off this franchise. And if you're coming
now,
in...
Now what are we talking about? We're not talking about racism. We're talking about financial interests.
Exactly. And these financial interests, they have a stake in this idea that there is no such thing as reincarnation, that history, in fact, only goes one way. The Egyptians built the pyramids, even though when you get to Cairo, it's instant. It takes, I don't know, less than a second to realize that there is no connection whatsoever between modern Cairo and the Great Pyramids.
Sure.
No connection whatsoever. They just happen to be located beside one another.
And it's not unlike going down to Teotihuacan and hearing at least Aztec guides, Aztec descendants, tell the story of how the Mayan people migrated east from the coast,
mm-hmm.
being driven there by hurricanes and volcanoes and all kinds of other natural disasters, walking up upon a completely deserted, brand new alabaster city, all built and there,
can
no shards of pottery, no artwork, no nothing, just sitting there ready for them to occupy.
Mm-hmm.
And then modern history records that the Mayans actually built Teotihuacan, which is a complete fabrication.
Right. I mean, it just as you're saying that, Brooks, I'm thinking, just think of the resources that civilization must have had, where they could build this and then just evacuate it. And I don't know, I was recalling when we were at Mount Shasta and you were telling me about the enormous ships that are known to be flying over Earth's skies, and I'm just thinking about the vastness of the resources that this civilization that could build such temples and could also then possibly be the same beings that are traveling in the stars above the Earth. And you just think, wow, what do they really have access to?
Well, we're going to cover that in a little bit more as we come back. We're going to take a short break. My guest is William Henry, and this is X Squared Radio. We'll be back in about 5.5 minutes, so take yourself a break. Listen to some commercials. Help us out a little bit here at X Squared Radio. We'll be back after these messages. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. OvernightPrint.com is your new source for business cards, postcards, and brochures. The best card stock on earth, easy-to-use online ordering tools, and overnight delivery available. Click on the OvernightPrints.com banner, and don't forget to use the X Squared code for an extra 10% off and free shipping. Come on, these are world-class business cards at your fingertips. Stop waiting for 2 weeks and paying over $100 for second-rate business cards. Get action fast, as low as $9.95 at OvernightPrints.com. Chances are you own an inkjet printer. They're very cheap to buy, but those supplies can be outrageous. How about clicking on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio? Very inexpensive supplies, free shipping, and a chance to win a free printer every time you buy. Now, how cool is that? Check out 123 Inkjets at x2-radio.com. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Getting all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, send in the call letters of your local station, and we'll take care of the rest down here. We are coming to you live from Santa Monica, California this week, down here doing some engineering work, part of the day job that helps keep X Squared Radio alive and well. Wanted to give you an update on the Inner Earth Expedition. We have made some strides. While we're down here in Santa Monica, we're talking with the producers that submit projects to the Discovery Channel and also National Geographic. And although this is a very large project, much larger than any cable channel could take on by themselves, they have shown great interest in our work. And we've shown them our part one of the documentary, and you know that the Japanese version aired in May in Japan and took first place in the Genes of Galileo contest. 17 million Japanese, can't be wrong. So it sounds like we have a winning hypothesis here, and we're building support. The only thing that I would ask is that the 12 million of you each week that pop into bbsradio.com give a call to Discovery Channel or to National Geographic and tell them you'd like to see the documentary air on that program. We are going to Egypt in January. We're going to film part two of the Inner Earth Expedition, try to bring to you some of the antiquity of the ideas behind the connection between the human being and the planet Earth and maybe the cosmos. And we may film part three in Sri Lanka, going there with Mark Pinkham and his event in Sri Lanka. We're going to have the Yes It Is representative here on the 16th of September, so you don't want to miss that program. That's going to be very powerful. The world's oldest organized religion, the only representative in on this side of the world, and we'll have a translator so that we can get your questions to him and the answers back. And we're going to try to see if we can bring the religious and scientific community together one more time and see if we can hammer out some peace. And don't forget the World Peace Concert coming up in October in New York. About everybody is going to be there. I hope to be there myself. So that's the progress that we've made with the expedition and some other things. My guest tonight is William Henry. We want to make sure that you keep current. So make sure that you got the phone lines written down. I'll give them to you one more time here. Anywhere in the U.S., toll-free, 877-876-5227. Toll-free, Canada, 888-810-8322. We have a lot of listeners up there in Canada. And anywhere else on the planet or off-planet, if you can make your way to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-876-3222. Phone lines open for the next 2 hours, so we'll take your calls. We have four lines, so you can stack them up. We'll take them all. William, welcome back.
Thank you, Brooks.
What we're going to want to try to get into now, we're going to make a really right-hand turn and begin to tie not just the antiquity of the land and the civilization together, but the correlation with the human being. Now, recently you gave a series of lectures on the light body effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to, you know, as we tie this stuff together, this is, we have more tale to tell here. So let's talk about the light body effect. What is the key that got you thinking about this amazing discovery, and what is it?
Well, actually, what happened, I was at a conference last year or 2 years ago, and I had a really just a wonderful couple come up to me. As you know how that goes at conferences, Brooks, you're there, you got a
sure.
table, people
oh, yeah.
come up, hey, read your book, loved it, and you're like, wow, thanks, and you know, you don't expect it to go much further than that. But then this couple said, no, listen, we're really serious. We both have PhDs from the Harvard Divinity School, and we know all the lamas that have come from Tibet and elsewhere to the West. We work with Robert Thurman. We work with a lot of the translators. We know the Dalai Lama. And they said, your work answers for us a question that the Tibetans never would answer. And they proceeded to tell me about this tradition called the Great Perfection, where the Tibetan lamas would enter a hut for, say, 49 days.
Yeah.
And at the end of that period, when they would reopen the hut, there would be nothing left in there except hair, toe, and fingernails, which have no nerves to be transmuted. And what would happen is that these lamas would shift the vibration of their body and literally dematerialize into a vortex of energy. And they said that your work answers for us what happens to those beings, those lamas, after they effect this transfiguration, which is what it is. They open a wormhole and perhaps travel to any one of the 28 different solar systems that the Tibetans talk about. And so this got me on this whole research path to understand this whole idea of the Great Perfection, whereby an individual can transmute their body into pure energy and travel the galaxy. What I started to do is to link this up with the stories of Osiris in Egypt, who you can interpret the artwork at the Temple of Abydos as wormhole imagery, the depictions of his ship of eternity that Osiris will travel into the stars for eternity upon. The way that that ship is drawn precisely matches the way modern science portrays a wormhole.
Wow.
And I'm asking modern physicists and high-energy physics types to look at is say, okay, maybe it's improbable that the ancient Egyptian gods who built the pyramids, who left us this incredibly advanced civilization, traveled the stars in wormholes. That may be far-fetched, but it's not far-fetched to say that those who are involved in the design of these wormholes today can learn an awful lot about going back and looking at this ancient artwork that portrays these god beings coming and going from the stars, not in spaceships, but sailing upon craft that are identical to the way we portray a wormhole today.
Now, what could you transport through a wormhole? Would it have to be a special titanium ship, or could you literally be like a Tibetan Lama and everything except the hair and fingernails goes through?
Well, I think that what you see referenced in the Gnostic Christian take on this, which is the there was a massive research project that was undertaken at the time of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. It was undertaken by Jesus, by Mary Magdalene, by John the Baptist, by Joseph of Arimathea, all these biblical figures, the titles, the titular figures that we know of in the Bible, were tremendous esoteric researchers who were scouring. They had access to the Library of Alexandria. They went to Egypt. They went to Iran, Iraq, India, Tibet, assimilating all this knowledge and how a mortal being can transfigure themselves into a being of pure light so that, in Jesus' words, they can inherit the light of the kingdom. And so they have this massive effort to understand how it was possible for this to happen. And in their text, they make it clear that this body is not going anywhere. They viewed the human body, this mortal coil, as a simple covering, as a tool, in fact, which is a little bit more of a complicated idea, but they viewed it as a simple covering that was disposed of. And what actually was transported or teleported through these wormholes was something that they referred to as the divine spark, the seed atom within us that has within its coding the ability to grow a human body and to use that body as a ladder or stairway to heaven.
Wow. Now, this is something really landmark. So this idea, I mean, is the light body the real person and the physical body on this earth just an illusion, or is it just a covering? Or
just a different covering. And the research that I do is to look at these ancient depictions of the body, and especially to look at, like, Egyptian temples. The temple at Karnak is a fantastic example. They call it the Temple of Man, because so many of these temples are, in fact, models of the human body and allude to the esoteric function of the body as a ladder or stairway to heaven, as a device that the soul can use to return to its source.
Now, what is it about the body that exactly is the ladder? Are we talking the spinal cord and the rib cage and the alignment of the chakras? Is this the ladder?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And in fact, when we talked earlier about this second century Chinese diagram of Mount Meru that is mimicked here in Nashville.
Yeah.
I should mention also that when I first started giving presentations about FDR's quest for the Grail and started showing that diagram, I had a scientist come up to me one day after a presentation, and he said, "Hey, I was basically asleep through your presentation until you put up that blueprint." And I said, "What blueprint?" And he went through my slides until he came to that diagram, which, again, you can see on my site at williamhenry.net. It's in my blog, and it's in that article called City of Secrets. And this guy proceeded to tell me that he's a scientist who designs weapon systems. And what we're looking at in that diagram is actually a blueprint for a particle beam weapon, a particle accelerator. And so I'm thinking, well, okay, so what in the world is a blueprint for a particle accelerator doing in a second century Chinese manuscript? And why does it so closely resemble a human spinal cord system? I mean, anybody looking at that diagram instantly says, that's human vertebrae that we're looking at. We can see the pelvis, and you can see the vertebrae. And so I started making this connection. I wonder, is the human body, as the Kabbalistic tradition teaches, as so many traditions teach, literally the tree of life? And by tree of life, do they mean that the human body is like some kind of a particle accelerator or something? And so that's what got me on this line of research, that we might be talking about the human body as something far different than most of us ever contemplate.
Yeah, so we're not just a covering of corn-fed beef. We're actually a very well-designed, three-dimensional, functional piece of equipment that fits the human soul. And when I think about this, about, for instance, yoga, and the idea that the human spinal cord is actually a prana tube connected
exactly
to the earth and to the sky, and that human consciousness can actually accelerate prana or higher energies into the human body, which accelerates the soul to a higher vibrational level. Now, that sounds like particle or energy acceleration to me.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when you talk about this, you know, it brings up some really interesting questions, because let's just say, okay, this diagram of Meru, the cosmic axis, the ladder or stairway to heaven, which is easily understood and represented as, or identified as, human vertebrae. Let's just say that that's what it is. And then you go to the next stage and you say, okay, well, the book of Genesis says that we're made in the image of God. Well, if this diagram is a particle accelerator, does that mean, like, God is like a high-energy physics type or something? Or what is that exactly saying? And as I often like to say in presentations that get off on this sort of line of philosophical speculation, it's like people that have dogs, they will build sometimes a dog house for their dog. And they'll put a nice roof on it. They'll try to give their dog as many creature comforts as possible. And the reason why is because our dogs are our companions, and we love them, and they give us love back, and we want them to be as comfortable as we are. And it's just remarkable how dog houses are a harmonic of our own home. And so it would make sense that God, in designing the human body, would want his children to have the same kind of capabilities or comforts, if you will, that God is God. And so one of those would certainly be the ability to accelerate our energy into a light being so that we can become eternal beings. And
well,
what these diagrams are showing for us is that technology.
Here's maybe what I see in it. And when you talk about created in the image of God, you can't create something, you know, with a body without creating the DNA first.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA makes a lot of sense to me, that it is actually in the image of God. But human DNA is, by and large, turned off. It's not activated, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, many argue is proof for intervention theory, in the sense
right.
that it's impossible that we could have evolved here, because evolution, the very ground rules of evolution, demand that any evolution in a molecular or biomolecular structure gives that being some kind of environmental or ecological advantage.
Right.
And the DNA that's turned off in the human being is very, very complex, and gives, ostensibly, the human no advantage in this ecology, in this environment whatsoever, which means, irrefutably, that its complexity came from somewhere else. So if we are created in the image of God, we're given the DNA of God, and maybe this covering, this corn-fed beef that we walk around in, filled with various fluids, is a quiet model awaiting activation that will accelerate the soul into this higher realm. But for now, we're stuck in the world of NFL. We're in 3D. We experience broken bones and illness and love and sickness and disappointment and success and greed and all the other things that go with it. And by that experience, we grow. And hopefully, we get to a point like William does, that you find synchronicities that inspire you to pick up a book and maybe do a little reaching out into the unknown for answers. And that's why we're here at X Squared Radio, to try to bring you something that turns you on, that gets the particle accelerator and down which you throw your Big Macs to turn on and excite and
right.
realize that you are this eternal being of light.
Right. And so then what happens is, in my research quest here, is getting back to that couple who came up to me at the conference. They started saying, well, wait a minute, you need to start looking at this whole Tibetan great perfection tradition of these lamas that have the ability to do this, because they are doing what you are suggesting here. And as I've investigated this further, and by the way, I just love that photo you let me use at Mount Shasta of the stupa with the lama who had affected the rainbow body transfiguration. And rainbow body is the other term that they use for the great perfection. And it's unbelievable the record of of what has been left for us, and it's up to us now to make the trek to Tibet as you did, to go to Egypt, to go to these other places and pull all these pieces together, because they're telling this remarkable story. And it's kind of like the position that we're all in. We're sort of like the caterpillar looking up at the butterfly saying, "You'll never get me up in one of those things."
Yeah, exactly right.
Right?
Well, that brings me to my next question. You know, how detrimental to our eternal value is it if we don't pay attention to the message the ancients have left for us here?
Well, personally, I believe in reincarnation. So I think that if we don't get it in this lifetime, you'll be back around to get it another time.
Well, what happens if the planet isn't in the same condition it is right now? I mean, we're not doing a very good job of taking care of it right now.
Well, I mean, that just complicates things, doesn't it? I mean, and I'm being facetious. I mean, it's remarkable the condition that we're in right now and the state that we're in. But at the same time, it's so hopeful because there are people like you, Brooks, and others that are working on ideas that can radically transform the situation and very quickly as well. And I hold out hope that the answers are going to materialize in time for us to be able to make this happen, and that we will, as been prophesied, enjoy 1,000 years or more of a time where we can experience a golden age and a time of awakening and a time of enlightenment.
Yeah, we'll just talk about that just for a second. I don't want to get too much into the global politics of it, but it does appear that those that are at the reign of the gross national products of various governments, shall we say, have a sort of a eschatological view of the world, that we only get one shot at this, and he who dies with the most toys wins.
Right.
And those of us that have in mind that, hey, we're going to come back and take another shot at this if we don't make it this time, feel as though you're kind of messing it up for the rest of us. We've worked a long time to get here. That being said, we're looking at about 6.8 billion souls on the earth right now, more than have ever lived here before that we know of. Where are they all coming from, William?
That's a great question. I haven't really thought about that. I mean, I'm a believer in this whole idea of soul groups and soul spheres, but I don't know about this influx of souls, if they're maybe they've always been here and are suddenly finding bodies in which to inhabit, or growing bodies in which to inhabit, so that they can affect this transmutation on a mass level. I mean, I really think that as these concepts become more and more widespread, we're going to start seeing some dramatic changes in humankind. Some of it good, some of it not so good, and it's going to be quite rapid, this 100th monkey effect that comes in and flips the switch one way or the other.
Well, I mean, let's take the next step on your research here. Let's talk about Stargate metaphysics. If the Stargate works one way, is it possible that it works another way, that worlds that are coming to an end, some red giant is about to consume their world and there will be no more incarnations on that little planet, are now looking for another home, and they get their high consciousness together, they activate a Stargate, and they look for the little blue marble by a main sequence sun on the outer rim of the Milky Way. What about that?
That's entirely possible. I would would wholeheartedly agree with a scenario like that.
Well, it also might explain how the ideas get seeded into the next world, that maybe it isn't starships that come here and teach us, but maybe it is our older selves, as we're reincarnated on this planet. We sort of remember that genetic memory, or maybe we remember that soul memory. We crack through it in dreams or in meditations or in reaching out into the metaphysical light realm of discovery, and we say, hey, what about this design? What about this particle accelerator? I just dumped a cold beer down. Where did that come from? What does it mean? And then here comes all this pure knowledge, and next thing you know, it's etched in stone, and we go around again.
Yep. And more and more right now, I'm feeling an urge to... Part of me is saying, okay, we're going to be fine, everything's going to make it, but then another part of me is saying, well, it's time to leave a message for your future self.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm looking at the upcoming elections with some trepidation myself. There doesn't seem to be a person of wisdom lying in the wings who is, you know, in position politically to step forward and grab the helm and say, all right, let's have a steady hand here. We're not going to march toward Armageddon with guns a-blazing. We're a higher being, and we're on the verge of an incredible evolution and discovery. And we may cover a little bit of that in our third hour. So I guess my question is, it seems as though civilization from time to time reaches this precipice, whether it's Enoch or the Mayans or the Egyptians or the Atlanteans or the Lemurians. I guess my question is, did we somehow forget this over time, or do the temptations of three-dimensional life overcome our higher purpose time after time? What's your opinion on that?
Well, my thought is, one thing I noticed getting back to Egypt and Abydos is that, you see, Isis and Abydos operating a device that she calls, or is called Osiris, that resembles an antenna.
Right.
And it's clear that she's operating this device, and it looks like she's trying to draw a substance from somewhere. And I'm thinking, well, okay, Isis is serious. Is it possible that this technology that we're seeing here, what to our modern eye appears to be technology etched on the ancient walls here in Egypt, does it have something to do with Sirius? And, of course, then you get all the connections that flow in with various myths, the Dagon and others, that talk about advanced beings coming to this place from Sirius and settling civilization and so on and so forth. And then you also get into this really interesting research that was put forth by Walter Cruttenden that in his book Lost Star of Myth and Time, that says that Sirius is, in fact, our binary star, and that the magnetic field of Sirius is something that spawns awakened or periods of awakening. And when we're in the flow of the magnetic field of Sirius, and even a flow of particles from Sirius, a stream of life, if you will, or life stream, that we're in, when we're in that life stream, we're experiencing a period of awakening and enlightenment. When we're out of it, we're experiencing periods of darkness or sleep. And it turns out that we have been emerging from a period of darkness and are now entering a period of awakening and a period of light. So part of the answer to your question is that it could have to do with our relationship with such stars as Sirius and the flow of these enlightenment particles that awaken us. And it may be that when Isis is shown there with Osiris at Abydos, that operating a device that resembles an antenna, that she may have been attempting to beam or transmit or receive energy or vibrations or something of that nature coming from Sirius.
Huh. So are we talking about entangled particle theory here, where we have particles that are activated in a distant star system of Sirius having an effect on particles that are here on the Earth? Or do you think
that's a very good possibility, absolutely, because there's no question that whatever was harvested from this device brought about the awakening of individuals.
Mm.
And so that's part of what we're going to be looking at on our expedition when we go to Egypt, is looking at that in detail from this perspective, that's what they're doing, is operating this, what even appears to us to be even still very highly advanced technology, but yet they've left it for us on the temple walls awaiting rediscovery, and now is the time when we rediscover the secrets of this technology.
Well, do you think we need the leg up on the horse? Do you think we need this clue to get ourselves ready so that, you know, we don't say, hey, that particle stream that we felt about 10 years ago, it was meant to enlighten us, and, you know, it's already passed. Now we've got sort of a precursor, a primer, an introduction on the wall that prepares us for this period of enlightenment.
You know, I did, to, not to throw water on it, but there was a mathematician, Dr. Charles Muthes, who thought that the stream passed us by in 1997. But, you know, I mean, so that's a good question that you ask. Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but at the same time, you know, I'm also a big believer in synchronicity, that we wouldn't be rediscovering this now if we couldn't use it for our highest purpose.
I believe that, too, and I think there are a lot of synchronicities between you and me and other people here in Santa Monica and even elsewhere in the world. We're about to do something very, very remarkable. I can't tell people about the experiment that we're going to try, but we'll certainly bring you the film in February, and you'll be able to see the results of it. Well, let's talk about, in the rest of this hour, there is a master that ended up moving to Egypt at a very young age. Evidently, he was born in a little town of Bethlehem and became unpopular at a very young age due to some prophecies in the area. And his mother and father, Mary and Joseph, picked little Jesus up at the age of about two and moved to none other than Egypt. How long did they stay there, and how does the early life of Jesus tie into the history of Egypt?
I don't know exactly how long they stayed there, but one of the most remarkable things to me, one of the most remarkable places in Egypt is actually not far from Abydos. It's called the Temple of Dendera. It's a temple dedicated to the goddess Hathor, who's the goddess of love, joy, bliss. The Temple of Hathor was built at the time of Jesus. It was brand new, in fact, when Jesus was born. The interesting thing about this is that the word Dendera means house of bread.
And really?
When you go into Dendera, you're looking at a obviously feminine temple, and it is in the crypt beneath Dendera that you see those incredible that incredible scene of what appeared to be cathode ray tubes or an electric light bulb etched onto the wall.
Right, right.
And you had various chroniclers throughout time say that when they came to the crypt at Dendera, they saw the light there. Well, the interesting thing to me about this is that Dendera's name, again, means house of bread. So does another little word mean house of bread, and it's actually a place name that the biblical scholars have a difficult time agreeing on its exact original location. And that place I speak of is Bethlehem.
Uh-huh.
Bethlehem means house of bread, where Christ was born. Christ is the light, the way, the truth. Christ is not a person. It's an energy. It's a vibration. And I just find it remarkable that here's this temple at Dendera, built at exactly the time of Jesus, that has in its crypt the secrets of what we today recognize as the secrets of light.
Well, it does seem interesting that in, and now people in these days, by the way, did not travel the desert by themselves. They became part of a caravan. That's how they move around. That way you can carry enough supplies to get yourself there, protect yourself against bandits and nomads and things like that. And so there were regular caravans that went from Egypt back to Jerusalem, which is not far from Bethlehem, and then back again. And on one such journey, it appears, in the New Testament, it records that Jesus, at the age of 12, doesn't make the caravan home and ends up staying behind and teaching in the temple in Jerusalem. Well, it takes a few days for Mary and Joseph to find a caravan going back the other way, much as she might have wanted to. You don't just take off across the desert because your son didn't make the caravan. You have to be practical about these things or you'll perish in the desert. So I'm wondering, the 12-year-old Jesus that went back to Jerusalem with his parents and the 2-year-old Jesus who left Bethlehem originally to go to Egypt, that's a 10-year period in which a young boy is exposed not only to Egyptian teachings, but a great time of Egyptian awakening, almost like a renaissance of Egypt. How much did one influence the other, do you think?
Well, I think the answer is the influence is just tremendous, in the sense that, I mean, we have to remember that Jesus fulfills the model or the prophecies of the Messiah. It was Moses who previously had fulfilled that. Moses, of course, we're told in the Bible, was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. I mean, that covers a lot of ground, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so we have to think, I mean, there's reason to speculate here that Jesus also received that same wisdom. And, in fact, I have a presentation called The Lost Secrets of Jesus, The Wand in the Ring, in which I show the early Christian artwork that demonstrates that over and over again, in the catacombs of Rome especially, when they portray Jesus performing his miracles, he does so with a rod or a wand in his hand. Sometimes he's holding a rod and a ring. And these depictions, especially of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, they portray him taking this rod or wand. Jesus has this rod or wand, and he's conking Lazarus right on the crown chakra, as if to awaken him, recognizing that this is he's awakening him from a sleep state, a state of lack of knowledge, into a state of gnosis, or full and complete knowledge. Well, the thing about this is, Brooks, is that when you compare the earliest Christian depictions of Jesus raising Lazarus with that wand with the original Egyptian depictions at Abydos of Thoth, or Thoth, raising Seti, the king dressed as Osiris with the key of life, you see it is the exact same depiction. And so it poses several questions in my mind. One, what, did Jesus go to Abydos and learn the secrets of Thoth that were taught there? Did he learn the secrets of Osiris and how to raise a person from a sleeping state into an awakened state, raising the dead into life, speaking of transmitting this knowledge to them? Or is it possible, as some others suggest, that Jesus didn't actually exist at all, that they've just made up this figure as a composite figure based on the previous, what they refer to as pagan gods, including especially Hermes, Thoth, and others who were those who knew the secrets of alchemy and knew how to take a mortal human and turn him into an immortal being. Personally, I think there was a real figure who likely was not called Yeshua, although that's the name he's given. Might have been given another name. We don't really know what that person's actual name was. Jesus Christ is a title, like Mr. President is a title. Mary Magdalene is a title, like the First Lady is a title. There were many Christs throughout this time period. I think that there was an actual person, and that this person was deeply educated, or deeply steeped in the knowledge of ancient Egypt, knew the secrets that were represented on the walls, especially at Abydos, especially at Dendera, and undoubtedly knew the ultimate secrets of the Great Pyramid Complex at Giza.
And who was that person?
That's the figure that we call Jesus.
Uh-huh. Well, now, we're talking about Jesus at age 12, but mm-hmm. he didn't really show up back in Jordan until he was almost 30, right before his 30th birthday. So
exactly.
Where did he go from the time he was 12 to the time he was 29 and three quarters?
Right. Well, Nicholas Roerke's answer to that is he followed his trail from Jerusalem through Iraq, through Iran, through India, on into Mongolia. Claimed that he trained at the same monasteries that Yeshua trained at, read the same books, was privy to the knowledge of what was housed there, and that's when he came back and offered his research services up to Henry Wallace and FDR, and went back then on the expedition in 1934 looking for the secrets of Jesus. So I think there's really good evidence that that is the trail that he followed, and that we can, in fact, still follow that trail today with very interesting results.
Did he travel alone?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sure he did not travel alone. I mean, it would make sense not to travel alone. And again, the picture that my research reveals is that we are looking at, you know, a tremendous number of people, a research group that was specifically geared towards finding the secrets of releasing our inner divinity. And in particular, in response to a question in the Pistis Sophia, Jesus answers to Mary Magdalene by saying, "Cease not to seek day and night." In other words, do nothing except find the cleansing mysteries that will cleanse and purify you and make you into a perfect being, a perfect light, so that you can go on height and inherit the light of my kingdom. That's the knowledge that they were after. And while we talk about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and his four apostles and 12 disciples altogether and maybe even a 13th, I think we're talking about a lot more people than that. And so it would make sense to me that Jesus is not making these journeys solo. He's with an expeditionary force.
Yeah, and I think they made some remarkable discoveries. I think I also support that theory just based on my own research. I know somewhere in the early parts of the Pistis Sophia, it talks about this language of light. And J.J. Hertog does an incredible job of really putting this together. You have to use a highlighter every single line in the book, so you might as well just leave the highlighter out. But I think in there, if I recall, I think he says these five words. I think it's Zama, Zama, Oza, Rachama, Ozai, which is the language of light. And I think this has to do with the creative guardian. And it's kind of interesting how that all fits together. I know J.J. Hertog did an incredible amount of research to put this book together, but this book's actually dictated by Jesus and recorded and then translated into English by J.J. Hertog. So this is a really great work. If you have a chance, get your hands on it. It's not for the lighthearted. I think you need to read all of William's books first and get to that one to kind of prepare you, because it's pretty deep. Just to let you know that, you know, your host keeps up with all these books and tries to keep everybody read up so that I can converse with great minds like William here. But you know, what do you think he first learned when he arrived in the East? I mean, he's going to learn from the Eastern masters, all these monasteries. What message did Jesus learn while he was there?
Well, Brooks, I think what it was that he learned is demonstrated in what is referred to as the transfiguration or metamorphosis. This is when Jesus takes a couple of the disciples, Peter and James, up to the top of Mount Tabor, and transfigures is the word the Bible uses. It also uses the word metamorphoses or metamorphoses into a shining being, a being of light, a transfigured being. In other words, he is demonstrating his abilities to affect the great perfection or the light body transfiguration.
Who is he demonstrating that to?
Who's he demonstrating it to?
Yeah.
He's demonstrating it to the disciples.
All of them, or just...
No, just Peter and James.
Ah.
And while he's doing that, Moses and Elijah appear as if out of nowhere beside him. Well, the interesting thing is that the last time we saw Elijah in the Bible, he was ascending into the heavens in a whirlwind, some kind of a vortex. Moses disappears under mysterious circumstances. His body's never found. And what I wonder is if maybe the reason why Moses and Elijah appeared to Jesus in this state is because they too have affected the transfiguration into light beings.
Well, as I understand transfiguration, it's a temporary process, a temporary conditioning of the body that allows you to withstand the glory of God. Otherwise, you'd just be incinerated at his sight. It's not a permanent condition like,
right,
say, ascension or resurrection.
But right.
You know, I read in the New Testament when Peter, James, and John are taken to the Mount of Transfiguration and they're exposed to this, you know, they don't just stand there and learn from it. They fall to their face on the ground, and the first thing they want to do is build a temple to Moses and Elijah, and Jesus is saying, no, you guys don't get it, you see. I'm trying to explain something deeper here to you, but I know you're just fishermen, and I want you to understand what I'm trying to teach you here. Do you think they got it?
No, not really. I mean, you know, did you ever see that movie Cocoon?
Oh, yeah.
The way I think of the transfiguration is that it's sort of like in Cocoon, where they just first show you a glimpse of the light being beneath the cloak or skin, their covering.
Yeah, just sort of peel back the lower eyelid.
Exactly.
And show you the light.
Yeah, and in this case, the disciples are terrified by what they see. And for whatever reason, and then Jesus tells them on the way back down the mountain, hey, I'd appreciate if you would keep this quiet. And at first that didn't make any sense to me. It's like, why wouldn't he tell them to go tell everybody that, what you just saw? I think the reason is answered that he alludes to the fact that this is not for their generation. This is for the generation of the end times. And so it may be that if we are in fact in the end times, as so many believe, it may be that maybe this is why suddenly this whole interest in the light body effect of transfiguration of the great perfection is beginning to reach such higher levels now. Maybe this is the next step for us, as so many traditions allude to. I mean, every religious tradition has a name for the light body. They call it the diamond body, the light body, the rainbow body, the ultra-human. It's made of a supramental substance. We know a lot about this, but the thing is that very much like those disciples on that mountain, we don't spend a whole lot of time trying to affect that change within our own selves. But yet, that is the message that I take out of instances such as that, is that Jesus is demonstrating that that's what's inside of us. And he's further demonstrating that in the description of that transfiguration moment, Jesus is telling them that he is in fact one of the shining ones. He is an Anunnaki.
Wow.
He is of this bloodline going all the way back to Enki in ancient Sumeria. He is activating the latent capabilities within his DNA.
What do you think we have to do now to realize that we are, or at least have the potential to be, this light body? What do you think we have to do now?
Well, I've whittled it down in my own mind to a three-step process. We have to imagine it, then we have to believe it, then we have to live it. And I was really pleased to find that that's backed up by Tibetan belief as well. The first thing that they say we have to be able to do is to imagine this. We have to be able to look at our flesh and blood and recognize this is an incredibly divine being that we in fact are. And this body, this flesh and blood, is not at all what we have been programmed by our society to believe it is. So first we have to imagine something beyond, or imagine this body as in a process of growing into something beyond its present form. This gets back to this whole idea of the pupil form, or the butterfly, having to be able to recognize that it is in fact, has in fact enfolded within it a butterfly. Then once we imagine that as a possibility, we have to believe it. And we have to maintain our belief in this possibility and in this state of existence. And then we have to live our lives in accordance with the hope that this will actually happen to us. Now the problem here is that we're not taught from the time we can speak that we are in fact light beings, that we have this divine spark within us that is temporarily utilizing this body for a specific purpose, to try to grow itself into a being of light so that it can, as Jesus says in the Pistis Sophia, go on height and inherit the light of the kingdom. That's not part of our culture at all. And
no,
so,
our culture kind of beats us down and says that, you know, if at best, you know, we're entertainment for God and probably more likely filthy rags before God and can never please him.
That's right. Our body is filthy, it's disgusting, it's sinful, it stinks, and it must be controlled. And it's this control is only getting worse. It's getting worse, in fact, by the moment. We're just how many breaths away from having to take the chip, Brooks?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Well, so we have this three-step process, and maybe we could just go to the root word of it, and maybe not imagine, but image it. It is an image in your mind that you are a light body. And then belief has, well, it has some favorable and some unfavorable connotations. I mean, even the devils believe in God. It doesn't mean that they're a body of light. Maybe it has a little more to do with an action word called faith. You just have to You have to pour energy into it. You've got to pour your consciousness into this image that you are a being of light.
That's right. And in fact, the Gnostics, they had a saying. It said what they would do is they would make these incredibly beautiful icons, these images of transfiguration, of Jesus clothed in bright white clothing, standing before a radiant gateway, a circular gateway, usually even with concentric rings in it, looking very much like a modern stargate or a wormhole, with Moses and Elijah on each side. And the saying that accompanied the viewing or the experiencing of these images was that the image itself, the image will show you the way. And what we're beginning to figure out here is that they had, just like the ancient Egyptians professed that they had, they must have had extra senses that we've shut down that enabled them to connect with these images in a profound way, mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally, so that they could actually experience on all of those levels what was going on inside Jesus at the moment of that transfiguration. Today, neuroscientists talk about something called mirror neurons, which are neurons in our brain that fire and act the same way whether or not we're watching, for example, people play football on TV, or if we're actually playing football ourselves. These neurons, these mirror neurons, can't tell the difference, in other words, between a real and an imagined experience. And it may be that that's the key to the way the ancients perceived these images, that they activated these extra senses. I mean, as I said, the ancient Egyptians believe we have 360 senses. We acknowledge six.
Oh, we acknowledge five.
Five, yeah.
Six
if we're
lucky. One.
Yeah.
And two of mine don't work very well.
Right. So it's like, wait a minute. We're, you know, back to this discussion now. How come we're so in the dark here? Is it because of where we're at in our relationship with Sirius? Is it something coming from the galactic center or lack thereof? Is it a region of the galaxy that we're suddenly sailing into or sailing out of? Whatever it is, what we are challenged to do is to recognize that we have these extra abilities within us and then find ways that we can develop them.
Well, we've got a remarkable story here. We've got a well-trained Jesus who comes back to Jordan. He's got all these capabilities. He takes Peter, James, and John up to the top of a mountain. This is only recorded in one of the Gospels. And he exposes them to a temporary changing of their bodies so that they can withstand the glory of two beings who show up. And they witness this. And as far as I can tell, their mortal ministries, that of Peter, James, and John, really didn't change much after this event. They changed more after the crucifixion than they did after this event. But it's clear that there was a distinction between the physical, you know, dust-kicking body that they were familiar with, and you know that they were trapped in and day out. And this one that Jesus was trying to describe to them, how similar is this to the teachings of the Buddha and the Dalai Lama or the Lamas in the time of Jesus?
Well, actually, the Tibetan, the Great Perfection tradition, doesn't get documented. It's not supposed to have been taught in Tibet until around the 8th century when Padmasambhava brings it from India. So in Tibet at the time of Jesus, it's not really happening, but in India, it is happening at the time of Jesus. It's also happening in Babylon, too, by the way, Brooks, because in the book of Daniel, he records a visitation by an angel who is described in virtually identical terms to Jesus in the Transfiguration. And also Jesus when he turns up in the book of Revelation before John. We're talking about a being whose face shone like the sun and his body was like a diamond or like lightning in terms of its brightness and his shimmering or his glimmering. So we know that there are these beings that are toggling between our realm and the realm in which they inhabit as these sort of beings in their rainbow body or diamond body. And what I'm trying to do is gather as many of these examples as possible, just to begin to set up a target. They're appearing to us in this form because they know that you and I can affect this transfiguration or transmutation as well. But nobody is teaching us how to do it. And I think your point about the crucifixion is really important because, in my mind, I mean, yeah, I know the importance that Christianity puts on the crucifixion, but it just seems to me that that transfiguration is like the key event. And something happened historically. We know what, in fact, happened. The reason why we see the images of the suffering Jesus on the cross as opposed to the Jesus as a transfigured light being. But yet I think that what we have to do is get back into this image and really start to put as much attention, focus, energy, and emotion on the transfiguration as we do on the crucifixion of what happened there.
Oh, I am absolutely with you there, and we're going to cover that a lot more in our final hour with William Henry. Don't go away. We're going to take a quick break, 4 or 5 minutes, pay a little bills here. Don't forget to visit our affiliates, because that helps us keep X Squared Radio on the air. We'll be back in just a little bit with more of William Henry on X Squared Radio. OvernightPrints.com is your new source for business cards, postcards, and brochures. The best card stock on earth, easy-to-use online ordering tools, and overnight delivery available. Click on the OvernightPrints.com banner, and don't forget to use the X-Squared code for an extra 10% off and free shipping. Come on, these are world-class business cards at your fingertips. Stop waiting for 2 weeks and paying over $100 for second-rate business cards. Get action fast, as low as $9.95 at OvernightPrints.com. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Chances are you own an inkjet printer. They're very cheap to buy, but those supplies can be outrageous. How about clicking on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio? Very inexpensive supplies, free shipping, and a chance to win a free printer every time you buy. Now, how cool is that? Check out 123 Inkjet at x2-radio.com. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. you're not getting all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, please let us know, and we'll get a hold of your affiliates and change that for you. I do want to make sure that you have the phone lines on so that you can call in anytime. It's toll-free in the U.S., 877-876-5227. Anywhere toll-free in Canada, 888-810-8322. And anywhere on planet or off planet, you can reach us through any cell phone tower out there at 530-876-3222. I also wanted to let you know that the Physics of the Soul workshop, it's a six-hour workshop. It'll be made available to you by DVD, video of it, on the website shortly. We have a long version and we have a short version, a 45, actually an hour and a half version that we did at the UFO Expo last week. We're going to put that up there for you. And we're also going to make the PowerPoint presentation for the Inner Earth Expedition available to you. And that way you can show it in your schools and colleges and try to understand maybe Hollow Earth theory a little bit closer, what we've learned so far and what our planned experiments are going to be next summer. We get a lot of mail from people who say, oh gee, have you already left for the Inner Earth? I missed it. You know, when's it going to come on? It's not going to happen till next summer. We are working very closely with some producers and also some private investors to make sure that the expedition takes place. It's not the least expensive route we're taking. We could, you know, reserve two seats on the nearest ocean liner and fabricate something fictional for you. But that's not what we're about here at X Squared Radio. We try to go after the truth, and we try to do the best Earth exploring that we can. And we occasionally get into places that no one else gets. And one of those recent trips that we took last March, ended up April 15th, was in Tibet. And we took a particularly grueling course on the upper plateau of Tibet. And we ended up in a special place called Shigatse. And in Shigatse, we discovered a stupa, which is a 60-foot tall, 4,300-pound in gold replica of a Tesla coil. We actually go through the physics of this and the construction of this in our DVD called The Inner Earth Expedition Part 1, and you can pick that up at the website. You could also pick it up at Amazon.com. But in this excursion, we managed to take a very unique photograph. It doesn't exist anywhere else except on my personal camera. I took the picture myself, and I was able to be privileged to hook up with William up in Mount Shasta, and he was giving a presentation on the light body and the energy body and the rainbow energy coming out of the human body, and it was documented by the Tibetans in another painting. And we hooked the two pictures together, and oh my gosh, what a connection. And it really turned everything on. It turned my presentation on, and it turned, it gave another dimension to Williams, and it was just a really fabulous discovery. So if you get a chance, make sure that you get to Williams' website. It's williamhenry.net, and pick up that DVD. That particular DVD is titled, I believe it's titled, The Light Body Effect. Imagine it, believe it, and live it. Pick that DVD up and look at that image in there, and then pick up the Inner Earth Expedition Part 1 and put the two together. And my goodness, you're going to come to an awakening like you never thought possible. Well, William, welcome back to the third and final hour.
Yeah, thanks, Brooks. Yeah, that was so exciting, that afternoon, just being able to put those pieces together, because I mean, what it does is it just really draws a direct connection and links what the Tibetans were showing. And the way they showed their Lama, especially in the rainbow body and surrounded by those sapphire blue stones.
Oh, that was incredible. I mean, they literally built this about 2,000-pound gold cocoon inside of which they inter the body of a Panchen Lama. And it's sort of cut away, like you'd see a geode, you know, one of these stones that's hit by lightning, you kind of cut it open and look at the insides.
Right.
Well, that's on display for people to see. And, well, it's not on display. You really have to go through some Chinese guards to get there, and they don't allow people to take pictures of it, but we were forthcoming with little yuan, and that got us where we needed to be. But had we not got behind those doors, we would have never seen it. And I can tell you, my guide's been there over 50 times in his lifetime, and he's never gotten behind those doors. And it just happened to happen this time, just right, and we brought it to you. So if you want to see one of the rarest photographs in the world, order those two DVDs and put the pieces together the way we did.
Yeah, I mean, because it shows the Lama in the stupa, in the cutaway, surrounded with the rainbow energy around his body, indicating their light body or rainbow body, and then he's got the blue stones that form that kind of cocoon around him. And then when you go to Abydos in Egypt, you see Seti as Osiris transformed into the ascended form of Osiris, and the top half of his body is completely covered with blue sapphire stones. And the view the Egyptians show is this profile view where you see Seti as Osiris on his boat of eternity, sailing into eternity, with the sapphire blue stones completely surrounding the top part of his body. And the ship that he's riding upon is easily comparable to the way modern science, again, portrays a wormhole. So the message that I take from this and that I'm operating on as a research premise is that, hey, is it possible that what we're seeing here is Seti dematerializing? Is he being transfigured into a light being preparatory to traveling through this wormhole?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that Osiris device. I mean, you know, when you look at Egyptian art, okay, one of the first things that people notice is, gee, everybody's kind of flat on the wall. I mean, one foot's behind the other, you know, like they were, you know, wet and just tossed up on the wall flat. And that's the way you look at everything that they draw. So they got this drawing of the Osiris device. And by the way, where is the hieroglyph? Where is the drawing of it located in Egypt?
It's actually, there are three places that I've found the best examples. The first is at Abydos, the gateway to the underworld, which was one of Egypt's oldest temples, a place where people were making pilgrimages to for over 3,000 years. A second place is the Temple of Hathor at Dendera, and then the third is the Temple of Isis at Philae. Those are the three places where you see the most profound examples of the Osiris device etched onto the walls.
Now, one of the things about Egyptian art is you only get the front view. There's no top view of anything. All
right.
You get is the front view. And one of my other associates, actually it's an associate of William Henry and me, his name is John D. Riley. He said, you know, you guys are looking at this all wrong. You need to look at it in three dimensions.
Uh-huh.
Imagine yourself flying up above this thing and looking down on it. And now what do you see, William?
Well, I mean, I've tried to do that. I have an artistic collaborator, Mr. Dana Augustine.
Uh-huh.
And so we actually did that with the Osiris device. And, gosh, I should open up the file here. I haven't thought about this in a while. But I said, Dana, I want to see this thing from as many different angles as you possibly can. So what Dana had done is he had taken the original Egyptian artwork, flipped it into his Poser program, which is a modern 3D art program, and started giving me spinning off these different views. And when you looked at the Osiris device from the top down, as I recall, it looked, well, first of all, the pillar itself, it's really basically two parts. It's a pillar that sits on a platform that resembles the Ark of the Covenant. And so when I looked at it, when we looked at it from the top down, basically all we saw was this golden square, which is the golden platform that it sits on top of, and the pillar became, in fact, a hole in that square.
Well, on the left and right of the Osiris device, as you look at it from the front, there's kind of a like a long telephone pole device on each side, and on the top of that is a rectangular, almost looks like a platform, and on the platform is standing a man and an ox on both sides.
Right.
Well, it looks like it's just a table and man and ox standing up there, and there's, it doesn't really make any sense, but when you look at it from the top and you imagine those tables as being round like carousels, and you realize that the man might be actually leading that ox around that circle. In other words, he's turning that shaft with ox power.
Uh-huh.
Now you have an electromagnetic generator on both sides of this device.
Uh-huh.
Now it gets exciting. Now you start seeing, now wait a minute, the Egyptians were very good at working gold, very good at working copper. What did they build here? And before we get to that question, let me see if we can't get this caller in. We have a caller on line 4. Caller, what's your first name and where are you calling from?
It's Gail, and I'm calling from Tennessee, from Nashville.
Hi, Gail. I think we've had you on the program before. Welcome back.
Hi.
Question.
Yes, it's been a while. I can't remember which guest it was you had on, but you always have fantastic guests.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great honor to talk to you, William. I've wanted to speak to you for years.
Well, thank you, Gail. It's very nice to talk with you.
I've been a great fan of your work. I'm curious if you maybe, boy, there's so many things that I want to touch base with you so I can get some input from you, and of course, Brooks also. But one time you were on Coast to Coast talking about the mound that the Capitol building in Nashville sets on, if you could talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also about stargates over here in the Smoky Mountains.
Right.
And then also, if you could, would talk about some of the real reason of going into Iraq, the Stargate technology that was over there, and something to do with them performing some kind of a ritual at the old temple where Nebuchadnezzar was. Of course, you know Saddam claimed to be the reincarnation of him.
Mm-hmm.
And they did something. I don't know if they were trying to resurrect one of the Nephilim or if trying to invoke their energy into the world, into the planetary grids right now or not. I'll take those answers off the phone.
You want me to talk about all of that tonight?
Yeah.
Well, just kind of briefly touch over some of it, please.
Gail's really good at coming up with whole three-hour shows by herself. It's really good.
Golly. Well, let's see. Let me just see if I can go on a tear here for a moment. I mean, it's kind of like playing Twister, answering these four questions all together.
Yeah, well, hang out, Gail, and see how we answer the questions, and maybe you can help guide us a little bit. All right, you want to start at the top. We're talking about the Capitol building on the hill in Nashville.
Right. Yeah, it's an artificially tiered mound, and in the photographs, I mean, even as old as the Civil War times, in the photographs from the Civil War, you can see that it was artificially tiered even then. So somebody long time ago wanted it to appear sort of like a step pyramid, almost very similar, in fact, to what you see at Teotihuacan, that same kind of tiering.
What's it built out of?
Lots of mysteries about that whole place. Some people think it's actually hollow, that there's stuff buried in there, that there's tunnels running underneath Nashville. You hear the, you know, there's just a whole bunch of different rumors that you hear about stuff like that. But, again, what I'm really most keying on is the 2,200-foot-long living rod or wand that is in front of the Capitol. And she brings up Saddam, which is a really interesting point to make here, is that Saddam built one of these magician's rod or wands in Baghdad. And he did this in 1996. It's actually a clock tower. And as a matter of fact, the very top of the Bicentennial Capitol Mall in Nashville is also a clock tower. And
wow.
when you put these two complexes side by side, they're virtually identical. It's the same principle that we see in effect here. And you wonder, well, what's Saddam doing with all of this? Well, Saddam knew what Heinrich Himmler also knew, who, and it was Himmler who also built a similar complex in Germany, or had plans to build a similar complex in Germany. Himmler called his complex the Spear of Destiny, and he knew that whoever controlled the Spear of Destiny, as the legend said, would control the destiny of the world. And I think that the reason why Saddam built this place in Baghdad is because he had done a great job hitting the books and doing incredible research about ancient Iraq, and in fact had made it publicly known that he wanted to transform Baghdad into sort of like a Disneyland for the ancient gods of Iraq, the Anunnaki. He had cast a jealous eye on Egypt and all the tourism that was all the tourism dollars that were coming into Egypt, and wanted people to come to Baghdad. So he spent tremendous effort gathering together thousands upon thousands of tablets from the ancient world in Iraq, and gathered all this stuff together, some of it in the National Museum in Iraq there, others of it in other museums around Baghdad, and really was doing everything he could to bring forward the secrets of the ancient gods in fulfillment of the prophecy that he was the biblical king Nebuchadnezzar, which is just an astonishing story. But let me just mention something about why it is that the Nashville Mall and Saddam's clock tower appeared to be the same design. And the answer came to me from a retired priest at Notre Dame University who spent years researching the sacred geometry and the layout of Notre Dame University, noticing, for one thing, that it's on a ley line that extends from South Bend, Indiana, all the way into the Bermuda Triangle. And in a radio interview, somebody asked him, why was it that they sought to, when they built Notre Dame University in South Bend, why was it that they were trying to duplicate the layout or the design of various cathedrals throughout Europe? And the answer that he gave really stuck with me, and I think it applies to both Nashville and to Saddam's complex in Baghdad. He said the reason why these old world designs and constructions show up in the new world is so that when the gods return, they'll know where to go.
Oh, that's interesting.
These designs, they look like sort of a keyhole. They're clearly rods or wands, but they are shaped this way and repeatedly throughout history so that when the gods return, they can use them as portals or doorways. And they'll know where to go.
These are of such size that they can be seen from high altitude.
Exactly.
I wonder if you're flying over Nashville at, say, 8 miles up, 40,000 feet, can you see this rod from up there?
That's a good question, Brooks. I haven't actually done that, but I'll have to...
Nashville isn't exactly flyover country, but it does have a... I may have to do that next time I fly over Nashville.
Yeah, you know, on that, just another anecdote. I remembered reading a long time ago in one of Zechariah Sitchin's books, his hypothesis that the Great Pyramid was a landing beacon for the Anunnaki. As he pointed out, the limestone covering the casing stones that were originally there would have been like a giant mirror. And I remember reading that thinking, wow, you know, that's a lot of bother just to build a landing beacon. And then one day I'm flying over Memphis coming home to Nashville, and I'm up at whatever, 36,000 feet, whatever, flying over Memphis. I look out the window, and I'm just about blinded by this incredible light. And when I look back again, I realized it was the sun reflecting off the glass pyramid of the pyramid arena in Memphis.
Really?
And I'm thinking, golly, Sitchin, he was right. There's no doubt that one of the functions, anyway, of the Great Pyramid must have been as a landing beacon, because that thing was just unbelievable in Memphis.
That is incredible. All right, what about Gail's other question about awakening an ancient Nephilim? Now, my understanding of the Nephilim is that these were the original 200 fallen angels that were cast to Earth. I guess they lowered their frequencies to a point where they couldn't return to higher realms. They were treated as gods. They had intercourse with mortal women and gave birth to the race of giants. I thought they were immortal. So why would you want to reawaken a Nephilim?
Well, because you're wanting to get a hold of their Stargate technology is my answer. And, it became kind of a urban legend. It became just basically common knowledge that Saddam was seeking the Stargate knowledge of the Anunnaki. And I can't take total credit for that story, but I did start talking about it, like with Art Bell, back in 1998. And I think I'm probably the first person to actually talk about this whole story, and I'd like to take credit for it, because at least my version of it really has some meat to it in terms of where Saddam got this whole idea. And again, as Gail pointed out, it's true, Saddam believed that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar. But the real meat of this story comes back to an episode that took place in the book of Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar went into Jerusalem and took the Jews captive, destroyed the Temple of Solomon and took the Jews captive and brought them back to Babylon, including Daniel, including Ezekiel, and including the three wise men from the Temple of Solomon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And what happens in this story is absolutely incredible. It appears that Nebuchadnezzar had this giant device that was parked out on the plain of Dura near Babylon. And he tried everything he could get his hands on or think of to make this piece of hardware work. He tried clapping, dancing, singing. The Bible mentions several other things, but nothing works. But he somehow realizes that these three wise men from the Temple of Solomon might have the software that can make this thing go. And so he bets them, he wagers with them, that if they can enter the fiery furnace that is operating alongside this device, that he'll convert to their religion. Well, in the story, these three wise men put on their coat, their hat, and their other garments, and they enter this fiery furnace. And when they come back out, not only are they in pristine condition, they're not alone. The book of Daniel tells us that the Son of God was with them.
Really?
Yeah. Other versions of the Bible say it's one like the Son of God, because if you're talking about the Son of God, then what you're saying here is that these three wise men entered this fiery furnace, a portal, a stargate, and returned with Jesus in tow. Now,
Jesus,
the book of Daniel drops the subject
while,
cold. Pardon me?
I said, Jesus wasn't going to be born for a little while yet, was he?
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes this such a strange story. So what happened here? Did they enter a portal, a stargate, and return with this figure in tow? And if so, what happened? I mean, did this guy, this figure, this Son of God, bring the secret of Jell-O with him? Did he bring the secret sauce for McDonald's? I mean, the Bible doesn't say anything about that. But in fact, Iraqi legend, lore, and history has a lot to say about this. In fact, the being's name was not Jesus, it was actually Nabu or Nebo, a name that means royal one or noble one. And as a matter of fact, Nebuchadnezzar is actually named for this figure. His name, Nabuchadnezzar, comes from this being, who is also thought of as a son of Marduk, who was a son of Enki, one of the original Anunnaki gods that came to earth in ancient times. And as we followed the story, or as I followed the story, it's like, okay, what happened was that there were whole temple complexes and vast libraries that were built by Nabu to house his knowledge. This is what Saddam Hussein was a hound dog over. He was all over the existence of those temples and those libraries. And I believe that it was that knowledge that he had assembled in Baghdad. And so if you have the knowledge of Nabu, it's likely you've also got the understanding and the knowledge of stargates and wormholes based on that episode in the book of Daniel. So based on that, I went on the Art Bell Show in 98, 99, and 2000 and was saying, look, Saddam Hussein's all about stargates. He's all about gathering this ancient knowledge, and up until 2001 I was talking about it, and then had even more ammunition, because by then a lot of the art newspapers around the world were reporting that that the UN weapons inspectors were going into Iraq and coming out with pockets full of ancient Iraqi cylinder seals and selling them on the black market. And Saddam was pissed off about that. And it wasn't many months later before we have a new president. And as I had predicted at that time before the election, that if George Bush and Dick Cheney get in office, we'll be in war at war within 6 months. I was wrong. It took 11 months or 12 months. But still, we could see that all of a sudden there was this race to gather this knowledge that Saddam was assembling it. And then no sooner had that knowledge come together in one place that we're suddenly invading Baghdad, and the very first thing we did was go into the Iraqi National Museum, which had been looted, and reclaim whatever it was that Saddam had so nicely assembled for us.
So I guess like the warehouse in Raiders of the Lost Ark, some of this ancient technology is now in Allied hands, and we're never going to see it.
We're never going to see it. That's right. Baghdad, before we're done with it over there, we won't want to go near that place for 1,000 years. And what happened to that knowledge is anybody's guess. Is it in Langley, Los Alamos? Maybe it's still there. And when we finally finish building our billion-dollar embassy there, maybe there will be some activity that takes place based on it there. I don't know. I went through a different phase, you know, after when we first went into Baghdad. I was kind of certainly not a lone wolf, but I was not very happy about it and not very popular on certain late night talk shows, expressing my ill feelings towards that war. And so I decided to back off. I got a little bit of a patriotic bone in my body and said, well, maybe those who are running this war really do know more about it than I do, ha-ha. And I just kind of sat back and just wanted to let the events unfold. But now I can, you know, we can all see that what a disaster it is. People are still looking for answers about what we're doing there. And the only answers that add up to me, the only reasons that make any sense is, as we talked earlier, we have rapture-crazy people that are running this war. They believe in the end-time scenario, the Armageddon scenario, and they understand or believe that in order for Jesus, in order for the Lord to return, Babylon had to be rebuilt so that it could be destroyed, so that then that could be one of the trigger moments for the return of Jesus Christ.
Yep, I understand that eschatological path, and maybe I'd like to say that maybe those that perpetrated the war knew at least as much as you do about it, and maybe the war wasn't about oil at all, maybe it was about Stargate technology, and maybe they're trying to reverse engineer that as we speak. Now, that's a topic worthy of X Squared Radio, and I can tell you right now, I'm on the trail, and I'm going to see if I can find somebody inside the government who knows what was discovered in those ancient museums, especially the special rooms that Saddam Hussein had. And I don't think it's so outrageous, because earlier in the program you mentioned that FDR himself had no small amount of energy going after, officially, the Holy Grail. Why? Is it because he had polio? I don't think so. Maybe it was because the Holy Grail had some kind of power that would empower a government, a country, a leader, to be the leader of the world. And I know it sounds crazy, but gosh, we've had FDR, we've had Hitler, we've had Nebuchadnezzar, we've had every leader that you could think of try to put in their coffers these holy, or at least extraterrestrial, artifacts. So that if they could learn how to use them, it would give them some eternal way to hold on to power and establish peace, as they call it, in the world. And I kind of back up William on this, that maybe there was, you know, greater, deeper motivations for going into Baghdad. Obviously, some of these cylinders making it out on the black market, maybe some of them made it into official hands. They got deciphered a little bit, and they said, oh my gosh, we think we know what Saddam Hussein has in one of these buildings, and if we don't get it from him, he's going to use it on us. And so here we go, after those archives of ancient and possibly very advanced technology. What do you feel about that, William?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I even at first had I was operating on a line of thinking. It's like, well, okay, Saddam, it looks like he's creating, and this is, again, coming from a lot of the art newspapers and that the people that follow the international trafficking in these ancient artifacts and that, they're a tremendous source of information about this kind of thing. And they're looking at Saddam and what he's trying to do culturally. I mean, he called the Berlin Museum and said, look, you know, the Germans, you were here in the 1870s, 1880s. You stole the Ishtar Gate of Babylon. I want it back. He called the British Museum and told them the thousands of tablets that the British stole from Iraq, that he wanted those returned to Iraq. And what they were seeing is that what he was trying to do was to enhance Iraq's tourist economy and at the same time to bring together this massive knowledge base. Hitler did the same thing. I mean, Hitler had a school of ancient Germanic studies. Saddam Hussein had the Saddam Hussein School for Ancient Cuneiform Studies. A part of these people, they have the love of power, there's no doubt about it, but they also have a respect for the ancient world and a love of ancient knowledge. And interestingly, in Saddam's case, he wanted to share that knowledge with the world and hope that people would actually come to Iraq. I was so naive back then, Brooks. I thought that once we went in there that we were going to be out of there in 6 months and we'd be doing tours of Iraq with Zach Sitchin. You know, I had the ad campaign already out, Iraq with Zach, you know, that we'd be able to actually go to Ur, and we could go to Babylon, and we could go and see all of this. Now, we don't have a prayer of seeing that stuff for, as I said, 1,000 years. They're going to leave that place so toxic that nobody will dream of going to that place, and it's the perfect cover for keeping everybody out so that they can do something in there.
Well, we're just going to have to go to Egypt ourselves and see if we can activate something that will render all this greed and efforts at hoarding this away from the population, or at least the race of mankind, null and void. And that's what maybe we can try to get that done. In our final half hour, William, I hate to change gears on this, but I want to try to get back to this subject and see if we can really open this up, and maybe this will answer the last of Gail's questions here. Was there a secret gospel of Jesus?
Oh, I'm convinced there was, absolutely. I mean, when you hear about all the parables are there because some will interpret them on one level and others on a mystery level. When you learn about the destruction of various texts outside of the accepted canon, you inevitably are left with the conclusion that, yes, there are indeed gospels that are out there that we don't know that much about. And one of them that I've been paying close attention to and tracking is referred to in southern France as the Book of Love. This is thought to be a symbol system that was taught to the people of southern France who called themselves the Cathars, the pure ones, by Jesus or by the disciples of Jesus, that contains such profound teachings that never again will blood be shed on the face of the earth. What we're talking about here is, I believe, the ultimate gospel, the ultimate teaching that has been withheld, and as my research continued on this, I realized or recognized that that's likely the reason why the Catholic Church went into the Languedoc region of southern France and inflicted the first European genocide on the Cathars. They were destroying these people because of this gospel of love, this book of love that they possessed, and went to the most extreme lengths conceivable to try to take that gospel from them, but were unsuccessful.
Hmm. Well, why would anyone want to take a gospel of love or a book of love from the earth?
You know, this gets back to this, really, what is at the root of so many of the questions that we've been talking about tonight. And this goes back to the ancient Anunnaki, as I understand it, and coming from my reading of some of, again, Zachariah Sitchin's works, in his reinterpretation of the ancient Sumerian myths, he talks about this battle between the gods, between two half-brothers, one named Enki and the other named Enlil. Enki is described or presented as a being whose who seeks to uplift humankind even to the level of the gods, or perhaps even to exceed the gods in capabilities. Enlil is very managerial and hands-on and appears to be more of a controlling figure who seeks to keep humankind at the level of slaves and sex objects. And as Sitchin proposed, and I've kind of followed on with this thought, it seems that you can track this battle throughout human history. You always have, even right up into modern times, you have one half of our government that seeks to raise the educational budget, while the other half of the government seeks to raise the military budget and to lower the educational budget.
Oh, right, exactly.
Okay? And so this battle's been going on practically since the beginning of humankind, maybe even before then. And so when we talk about a question, why would you want to remove a book of love from the planet, it goes back in my mind to that original battle between those half-brothers, where the church is obviously on the side that does not seek to allow humankind to match or exceed the capabilities of the gods. The church doesn't seem to be willing to allow humankind to transform or even transfigure into higher beings. And by the way, I always like to cite the example of the invention in the 14th century by an anonymous Italian inventor that caused the church to just absolutely flip its lid. When this invention hit the streets, suddenly the church was just repulsed and just actually, you know, just came out just wailing against this invention. The invention was eyeglasses.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And the reason why was because with eyeglasses came an idea, a brand new idea. And that idea was the human body is improvable.
Oh, right. That it's not perfect in its
exactly. The church's position was, if God wanted you to see, would have given you a decent set of eyes. Who
right.
are you to take control of God's work and put eyeglasses and believe that you can improve upon that?
How about that?
Okay.
How about that? And then what about the church's efforts to remove icons?
Exactly. The very what was thought of as the connection point between this realm and the divine realm, when the church was challenged by this new upstart religion called Islam, in the Islamics did not believe in the supernatural incarnation of a divine being such as Jesus. That's why they only referred to him as Jesus the Prophet. When the church is challenged by this new religion, Islam, which is effectively calling the church a bunch of upstart or a bunch of hillbillies who are idol worshiping hillbillies because they're making these incredible depictions called icons that they believe are little doors or gateways to literal doors or gateways to a higher realm, instead of really going after Islam and say, we believe in the power of the icons and the supernatural realm and the supernatural incarnation of this being, instead the church chose to withdraw the icons and succumb to the pressure put on it by Islam. Today, I think we're suffering from the results of that decision. We have a war on terror now that is really a war simply between radical Christianity and radical Islam. And all of us are being weighed in the balance. All of us are karmically attached to this war. And I personally believe it's time that we stop it. And one way that we stop it is by massively recognizing the existence of these supernatural realms, the existence of other dimensions, and bringing back the whole idea of this of transfiguration, of transformation, as something that is positive rather than negative.
Well, it's positive from our standpoint, but if you're putting together an organization that's designed to collect billions of dollars and maintain the governance of its rulers and its establishment and its founders, then it's not a good thing. You don't want the people to be empowered. You don't want them to be able to discover or, heaven forbid, reach God on their own.
Right.
No, they have to go through the organized religion. And if you don't live according to the rules of the rulers of the religion or religiosity, then you're thrown out, you're shunned, you're starved, you're somehow cut off from the presence of God. And, you know, we see that. It's just as active in Christianity as it is Islam. However, I have to say, from my own personal observation, the aggressor here is not necessarily Christianity. The first aggressor was Islam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went out with the sword and tried to spread their religion, and it doesn't appear to be one of human rights, I'm sorry to say.
I agree.
They sound like they're the good guys.
No, I agree, and I think that it was around, well, just after the time of Muhammad, the early 600s, 700, is when this flip happened, when all of a sudden the images of transfiguration of Jesus in his light being form in front of the radiant gateway, this is when those images really start to disappear en masse. You still see them in the Eastern Orthodox Church. But again, I think that this is the kind of imagery that we really need to be focusing on right now, because ultimately, it, as I said, it points to the possibilities that we all have, and essentially it tells us that everything that we're fighting for really is essentially just a waste of time, because we're so rooted in the material aspect of our bodies that we have lost almost complete touch with the spiritual aspect of ourselves. We've lost touch with the possibility that we can connect with a broader cosmos, and we see ourselves as isolated on a very lonely planet instead of part of something that is immense, beautiful, and wonderful, and need to take our energy and emotion and put in it into efforts that will enable us to more fully connect with all that is beautiful and wonderful in our cosmos.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I've seen your presentation on the light body effect, and one of the things that I remarked to you afterwards, it was so moving to me, was the unbelievable collection of artwork and icons and paintings and things that you have collected from around the world that clearly show that there is some higher portion to the human being that makes him not only incredibly amazing and complex and valuable, but it appears now very interesting to other races around the galaxy. It's one of the reasons why, you know, we attract so much traffic here on this little blue ball. We are some kind of amazing creation, and we shouldn't be knocking ourselves down, and we certainly should not be blowing each other up.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Brooks, because I wanted to talk with you about that. I mean, what do those beings in those craft think about us?
Well, I think some of them are making contact with people that are here, and they do see that we have an immense, unbelievable, unlimitless ability to love. And we have a limitless ability to accept and to learn, and I think there are even a handful, maybe an armload of beings on the planet that can learn everything. They can really gather and create and establish this transitory relationship between all these different disciplines, physics and music and love and art and architecture and childbirth. I mean, it's unbelievable how many synchronicities there are between one field and another.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe how amazing it is that I come together with musicians and artists and electrical engineers and painters, how all these pieces are fitting together. Everybody's getting the same message. They're interpreting it differently based on their own capabilities and their own aptitudes. But this is what's so interesting to those races that are visiting the Earth, is that we have such magnificent capabilities to join the galactic community. Now, there are, unfortunately, maybe it's because of our own abdication of leadership, because we'd rather spend more time learning and growing and gardening and having babies and going to sports events than we would ruling the planet. So
mm-hmm.
thus, as in any organizations, those willing to take the leadership role get it. And unfortunately, we get the lowest common denominator. They get to Washington and they say, holy cow, there's no end to the zeros I can write on these checks. And they seek to stay in power. And that's where the problem begins.
Yeah. Well, let's see where it ends.
Well, I don't know if I want to. I think I want to participate. I think I want to go to Egypt and I want to start something. I want to light a fire. I want to energize something that's been sleeping for a long, long time and see if we can't re-empower the human race to take control of our own destiny.
Well, I am such a believer in the whole idea of the 100th monkey and everything that that's what makes this time so exciting is that, I mean, you just see the way things so quickly spread across the net and people latch onto it and make adjustments to it and improve on it within themselves. I mean, I'm just so excited about the potentials that we have right now for sharing this kind of experience and sharing this kind of information, and I'm thrilled that you're coming to Egypt with me, Brooks. You're gonna have the trip of a lifetime, and it's going to be just so exciting to be there with you.
Well, I'm just like a little boy. I'm looking forward to it, but it's not just you and me. You know, we've got a group, we've got a crew that's coming that has capabilities that each person is going to be able to more or less hold a block to this pyramid. It's unbelievable what we're about to assemble here. And I guess, you know, you've been a student of history, and I certainly have been a reader of your work and a reader of history. Now, maybe we'll be a makers of history.
Yeah, that's a nice transition. I'll go right along that way with you.
Hey, if it doesn't work out, we'll be back.
Right.
You know, I come to this world not to be a spectator. You know, I had a really good teacher a long time ago. She said, you know, people are really just nothing but potatoes. She called people spectators and participatators, and she had all kinds of little finger puppets with potatoes on the end of them. Which one you were going to be in. I decided a long time ago that I was going to be a participator.
That's good.
That's what I am. So if you have me in your class, even if I'm sitting in the back, I'm going to be trouble. You can count on that.
Yeah, I always learn there's three types of people. Those who make things happen, those who watch things happen, and those who ask, is something happening?
And there's a fourth class. Did something just happen?
Right.
What did I miss? Hand me another beer. Come on. Yeah, I know. We live in a NASCAR world. It's just nothing but entertainment, and we sort of punctuate our lives with paychecks and summer vacations. But we need to realize that we are, just as William says, these eternal beings of light, and we're happening to be covered by, as I said, grade A beef on the hoof here. And we need to realize that we're actually housed in a particle accelerator, and all we have to do is energize and raise our consciousness, and the particle accelerator turns on, and amazing things begin to happen. You begin to manifest things in your life. Have you seen that too, William?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just the thoughts that you begin having as you begin to meditate on your body or act on your body as that kind of a tool or an instrument. Suddenly, your powers of manifestation increase. You find that you're not getting as sick as much, and you find that your life especially has a much higher purpose than you ever could have dreamed of before.
Well, that's what it's all about, having the higher purpose, discovering your purpose. You know, I sometimes do man on the street interviews, just take my microphone out on the sidewalk and
talk. Uh-huh.
And I ask them, hey, what's the purpose of life? And most of the time I get an answer like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And what happens to people after they take your class? If they come to Nashville and you look up William Henry, go to williamhenry.net, take one of his courses down here on the mall, and you take a small group of, say, 40 or 50 people, William, what happens to them by the end of 2 days when they go through your class of enlightenment?
Well, a lot of times what happens, you know, they'll get home and suddenly they start looking at their own hometown or wherever they're living with different eyes, and they see connections that they had never seen before, and that gets them excited. And you know, I mean, what I'm also, so I get that. That's kind of not really mundane. That's probably not the right word, but it's kind of pedestrian because that happens a lot. But boy, then there's some others, Brooks, that come in and they just absorb the material, and the next thing I know, I hear from them a couple months later, and they're like, at such a much higher level, I shouldn't even say it quite like this, but even higher than I am. I mean, it's just astonishing, and that's the role that I love to be able to play, is to take this research, put it into a kind of a compact form that a person can absorb. They take it, they digest it, and then when they're ready to give it back, it's at a much higher level, and that is so rewarding to me. It feels like I've done my job, because I just basically feel like the service that I provide for people is I've been able to go to some of these places, read the books, and put this material into a form that then they can take and then begin to access it themselves. And again, it's so mind-blowing and also inspiring when it's given back to you at a much higher level. I'm sure you've experienced something similar.
Oh, I certainly have. And of course, not to paint too big of a parallel here, but there was another teacher on the earth that said, look, all you really have to do is master your fears, understand what I'm telling you, and above all, love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you can love yourself, then you can also love your neighbor. And that's really one of the greatest commandments. It's one of the best pieces of advice he gave us. But he said, if you do this, you can do what I do and greater things.
Mm-hmm.
Even he was not afraid of his students surpassing him.
Right. Well
so
said,
yeah. Yeah, I really keyed in on that. I don't think you should ever, castigate your own self for saying that, you know, gee, I lit the fuse under this person and he became greater than me. He became my teacher, became my mentor, or he went to his city and his next thing you know, his whole city is translated.
Right.
It wouldn't bother me one bit if that happened. Not one bit. And, anyway, William, it has been absolutely fantastic having you on the program. I can't believe 3 hours goes by. And whenever we get together, it's like we're on the phone for an hour, and bam, 3 hours are gone.
I can't
believe it. And folks, it's the same way when we see each other in person. I mean, we go up on Mount Shasta, and the next thing you know, it's midnight. Or you know, it's just unbelievable how much time goes by when William and I get together. And it's just that way. And I appreciate the work that you do. I appreciate you coming on X Squared Radio. Without you, the station would be nothing. And your consciousness, your work, the love of what you do, the integrity you have with what you do, is what makes this work, your work, great. And it'll outlive both of us. I can tell you that.
I love it. Thanks, Brooks, so much.
You're very welcome, and you have a good evening, my friend, and we'll be talking soon, all right?
I look forward to it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that was one of my teachers, I'll say, my friend William Henry. We're building a relationship beyond education. It goes deeper and wider, further out into the cosmos than you can imagine. And each of you can participate in that as well. Just get yourself to williamhenry.net. I know many of you didn't call in tonight, and many of you will be tuning in on Tuesday after this Labor Day weekend at your desk as you work on your favorite project. Don't be afraid. Click on williamhenry.net. Get one of those DVDs. I'm telling you, they're very well produced. I don't mean to make it an infomercial, but every once in a while you come across a teacher that really gives you the depth and opens your eyes to what the ancients were trying to tell us and how important this is. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio, and I will play my exit. So have yourself a great rest of the weekend. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long,
you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.